little girl who never smiles, 'cause I've got braces on my teeth. And I know how it feels to cry myself.
That's right. Don't laugh at me. This here is Big Dot with you on another Thursday night show for the Jumbo Braille program here on the Excited Radio Network. Saying welcome one, welcome all to the program here tonight, especially our surrounding city and states, and our countries near and far, as well as those who've called 424-243-9617. Again, 424-243-9617. Press the number one. Join the conversation. We'd be glad to.
I have eight gold fishes. I was thinking of Bandicap.
We're glad to hear your questions, give your comments, and all that good stuff. So just be glad to hear from you tonight. So we're going to get started here tonight. We are going into our book again of Lost Moon, Apollo 13, the Perilous Voyage of Apollo 13. As we get into that tonight, we first want to give you a recap where we've been so far. So far, we've had little patches of him talking about his previous days before his mission on Apollo 13, Jim Lovell. But yet, at the same time, the actual mission, and we've gotten up in the mission as far as where they were getting ready to approach the moon. They've just done their mid-course correction to where they got back on their free turn trajectory. And so they've gotten all that squared away, and they're still having trouble finding the stars they need for alignment. So that's where they were when we broke off last time. So that's where we are at this time. And we just want to hear from anybody right now as to what their comments may be or if they got any questions. And I hear Six out there. How are you doing tonight, Six?
Brother, I am great. I am stuffed with Gordon Fisherman's fish sticks and fries and Gatorade, courtesy of Cafe McKell's. Great day. Great day. So this Apollo book seems to be very interesting. And just see where it leads from here. Yeah.
All right. And so tonight we're going to be getting into some real good stuff tonight as we get into our book tonight. And we do got a long ways to go for the amount of reading that we got to cover. And we hope everybody gets their beverage of choice. I'm going to grab me a nice Coca-Cola tonight, sit back, relax, and we hope you get your beverage of choice. What are you going to be drinking tonight there, Six?
Tony, but I think you said Gatorade.
Oh. All right. So I think what we'll do, we'll go ahead and get started here tonight. So we'll go ahead, Ruth, and give us the preliminaries.
Okay, tonight we'll be reading Lost Moon, The Perilous Voyage of Apollo 13 by Jim Lovell and Jeffrey Kluger. The narrator is L.J. Ganser. We'll be reading chapters 8 and 9. We hope all the listeners enjoy. Take it away, Kenny, on the Six Eyes Radio Network. Yeah.
8. Tuesday, April 14th, 1970, 7 a.m. Marilyn Lovell was thinking about Charlie Bassett and Elliot C. when she woke up on the morning after Apollo 13's accident. Marilyn hadn't thought about Bassett and C. for a long time. Like a lot of people associated with NASA, she preferred to put such matters out of her mind. But on Tuesday morning, April 14th, that was impossible. Technically, Marilyn did not wake up on the 14th because she did not actually go to sleep the night before. It was 7 a.m. when Marilyn began her day on Tuesday, leaving her bedroom after a restless nap she had begun only an hour or so earlier. At 6, Betty Benware and Elsa Johnson had rousted her from in front of the television, where she had spent most of the previous evening, moved her toward the staircase, and told her, in the clearest terms, that she was to get some sleep. Marilyn had objected, insisting that she wasn't tired, but Elsa and Betty reminded her that her children would be getting up soon, and she owed it to them, if not to herself, to take at least a quick nap. Marilyn grudgingly agreed, lay down on her bed, and after precisely an hour got back up and returned to the family room. When she did, it was with thoughts of Bassett and C. in her head. It was on February 28, 1966, that Charlie Bassett and Elliot C. died. Marilyn was at home that day, tending to Jeffrey, her fourth, and she pledged to herself, final child, born barely 7 weeks earlier. The winter just ending had been a frantic one, what with her husband leaving for his first spaceflight, the two-week mission of Gemini 7, during the penultimate month of her pregnancy, and reporters falling over themselves to interview the expectant mother and stoic wife. Shortly before Christmas, Jim returned, and shortly after that, Jeffrey was born, and Marilyn promised herself that the remaining weeks until spring would be as quiet as she could make them. She couldn't speak for her astronaut husband, but she intended to spend as much of her time as she could, staying home and tending to her newborn, with occasional assistance from a nurse or sitter if Timber Cove cabin fever grew too great. On February 28th, the nurse was on duty, and Marilyn was enjoying a tranquil moment while Jeffrey took a late morning nap. Then the phone rang. Marilyn, the sober voice on the other end of the line said, "It's John Young calling from the center." Marilyn would have recognized Young's voice even if he hadn't identified himself. He had joined NASA with her husband 4 years earlier and had been the first of the new recruits in space, flying with Gus Grissom the previous March in Gemini 3. "John, how are you?" Marilyn said, genuinely happy for the phone company. "Not well. There's been an accident," Young said. "Not involving Jim," he added quickly. "Jim's all right. But Charlie Bassett and Elliot C. aren't. They were trying to land their T-38 in the fog in St. Louis, overshot the runway, and hit the parking lot outside the McDonnell Aircraft Building. They were both killed instantly." Marilyn sat down slowly. She had known the Bassetts reasonably well. Charlie and his wife lived on the other side of nearby Taylor Lake in the community of El Lago, but since Charlie was in the third group of astronauts to join the program, the group that followed Jim's, Marilyn had never had the chance to do much more than chat with the couple at NASA functions. The C's, however, were Timber Cove folks, living just a few doors down from the Lovells. Elliot and Jim were both members of the second astronaut class, and in recent years, Marilyn Lovell and Marilyn C. had become close friends, often joking with each other about their common names, their near-common addresses, and their uncommon lives as astronaut wives. In the weeks Marilyn Lovell had been home with Jeffrey, Marilyn C. had been a welcome visitor. "Has anyone talked to Marilyn yet?" she now asked Young. "No," he said. "That's what I want you to do." "You want me to tell her that Elliot was killed?" Marilyn said, her voice rising. "No," Young said. "I want you to do something much harder. Not tell her. Somebody should be there with her right now, but she can't be told anything until I can come over and notify her officially. We don't want some overeager newspaper man knocking on her door. You do remember what happened when Ted Freeman was killed?" "Yes, John," Marilyn said, recalling the horror the NASA wives had felt several years earlier when the story began circulating about the reporter who knocked on the Freeman's door, wanting a few quotes from the family before the family even knew they had something to be quoted about. "Good," Young said. "I appreciate your help." Marilyn hung up the phone, found the nurse upstairs, and told her she'd be going out for a while to have a cup of coffee with a friend. Then she slipped into her coat and made her way slowly down the block. Marilyn C. was in her kitchen when Marilyn Lovell arrived, and when she saw her friend coming up the walk, she brightened visibly and waved her in. "I was just getting ready to go and visit you," Mrs. C. said to Mrs. Lovell. "I didn't want you to have to come out." "That's okay," Marilyn said. "I can always use the break. Besides, I've got at least an hour until Jeffrey gets up." "Is the nurse in today?" "No," Marilyn answered absently. "I mean, yes. Yes, she is." Marilyn C. looked at her oddly. "Are you all right?" she asked. "You seem distracted." "No, no, I'm fine." For the next 20 minutes or so, the two women sat and chatted and drank coffee. Then they heard the sound of tires in the driveway, and both women turned. Out the kitchen window, they could see a dark car pulling up to the house. Inside were John Young and another unidentified man. NASA personnel did not visit astronauts' houses unannounced unless there was a reason. Usually, it was a bad reason. The two wives' eyes met and held. Marilyn Lovell's gaze flickered for just a second, and in that second, Marilyn C. knew what that reason was. Without a word, Marilyn Lovell got up, answered the door, brought the visitors into Marilyn C.'s kitchen, and stood by her while they told her their news. Then she showed the men out, sat with her friend, embraced her, and finally did the only thing a friend and a pilot's wife could do in such a situation. Began phoning other friends and other pilots' wives and explaining what had happened. Within minutes, the first few wives arrived, and Marilyn Lovell ran back to her own house, jumped into her car, and sped off to the local elementary school to fetch the C's children and bring them home before they heard the news from somebody else. When she returned, the house, as she knew it would be, was filled with women and their somewhat awkward astronaut husbands, surrounding Marilyn C. and speaking whatever helpful words they could. Marilyn Lovell stood back from the group and watched for a long moment. She could not help wondering what her friend and neighbor was hearing at a time like this, what she was seeing, whether she even knew they were all there. Marilyn Lovell, like the wives of all the other astronauts, knew there was only one way she could ever know exactly what her friend was experiencing. But that was a possibility she had trained herself not to think about. 4 years later, on the fourth day of the mission of Apollo 13, Marilyn was learning those answers, and she deeply, dearly wished that she weren't. The night before had been a frenzied one from the moment the Bormans, the Benwares, the Conrads, the McCulloughs, and others from the NASA community arrived at the Lovells, parking on whatever patch of street, lawn, or sidewalk was available. Marilyn had no way of gauging the number of people who had been in her house at any one point, but judging by the number of full ashtrays and half-full coffee cups strewn around the family room this morning, not to mention the dozen or so people still wandering about the house or talking quietly among themselves in front of the TV, she would put the number at close to 60. For all of the friends and neighbors and protocol officers populating Marilyn's house, the people she had thought would need her attention the most, but who for now had demanded it the least, were her children. Jeffrey had been the first of the younger Lovells to be openly disturbed by the tumult in the family room, but Adeline Hannock had apparently satisfied his curiosity without raising his concern. The Lovell daughters had not needed any such explanations yet, and Marilyn was grateful for that. Barbara Lovell had evidently deduced her father's peril, and, judging by her darkened room, her clasped Bible, and her decision to retreat into sleep, was coping with it in her own self-sufficient way. Marilyn was reluctant to disturb her with words of encouragement she was not yet seeking. Nor did she want to bother her younger daughter, Susan, who, remarkably, had been sleeping through all of the early morning turmoil. Soon enough, Susan would awaken on her own and learn what the neighbors and the newsmen and much of the rest of the world already knew. Marilyn saw no reason to deprive her daughter now of what would almost certainly be the only true sleep she'd have for days. 14-year-old Jay was a somewhat different story. Phoning St. John's Military Academy at 3 in the morning, Marilyn had awakened one of the faculty members in Jay's dormitory, explained the crisis to him as briefly as she could, and asked him to break the news to Jay right away, before an early rising cadet could turn on a radio and tell him first. Ideally, Marilyn would have preferred to talk to her son herself, but that, she knew, might make things harder for him. Adolescent boys are given to more bravado than is strictly good for them, and adolescent boys who also happen to be cadets are given to even more. If Jay learned the news from his mother, he would almost certainly feel obliged to put on a stronger front than was good for him. Better for him to be told by a third party and then call home for more information when he had absorbed the news. The faculty member understood this, assured Marilyn he was on his way to Jay's room, and Marilyn had been trying to keep one line clear for Jay's return call ever since. The only other family member Marilyn had had to worry about this morning was Blanche Lovell, Jim's 75-year-old mother. Blanche, who had been strong enough and self-sufficient enough to raise her only son alone, had recently suffered a stroke and moved into a nearby nursing home, Friendswood. As near as Marilyn could tell, Blanche understood that her boy was to have gone into space this week, and she appeared to understand that his destination was the moon. But whether she knew he was going there to land or simply to go flying around it again was unclear, and this, Marilyn figured, was a good thing. With the landing now canceled, it was possible that when Blanche turned on her television, she would not even notice that her son's moonwalk was not to be found. She would notice, however, the reporters and their stories about the misfortune that had befallen his ship. To spare her the worry the rest of the earthbound Lovells would be experiencing today, Marilyn phoned the staff at Friendswood and instructed them that, until they were told otherwise, the television was to be removed from Blanche's room, and any questions Blanche asked about the flight were to be answered only with a smile and a hearty thumbs up. Now, as the sun was beginning to climb in the sky, Marilyn Lovell walked into the kitchen for a cup of coffee she did not especially want, and could sense that her house was beginning to stir again. Looking through the window, she saw that so, too, was the street in front of her house. The sidewalk, the driveway, and the lawn were suddenly clogged with men holding notebooks, microphones, and TV cameras. Several broadcast trucks had also converged, parking wherever they could find space. Marilyn looked at the scene somewhat incredulously. Weren't these the same people who had been so conspicuously absent for the last 2 days? The same ones who didn't carry her husband's broadcast last night? Who buried the news of his impending launch on the weather page? Who gave more time to Dick Cavett's jokes than to Jules Bergman's reports? From the study, the temporary hotline that had been set up between her house and the Space Center began ringing, and Marilyn could hear a protocol man answering it. There was a minute or so of quiet conversation, and then the man, one she didn't remember meeting last night, approached her in the kitchen. "Mrs. Lovell," he said uncertainly. "That was the public affairs office. The networks have contacted them and want to know if it's okay with you if they put up a broadcast tower in your yard for some of the coverage they're planning." "A broadcast tower? On my lawn?" Yes. They're holding on the phone, and I need to know what to tell them." Marilyn thought for a moment. "Nothing," she said. "Mrs. Lovell, I have to tell them something." "No, you don't have to tell them anything, but I have to tell them plenty." Marilyn walked back to the study with the protocol man following her and picked up the phone. "This is Marilyn Lovell. I'm told the network people want to build some kind of tower on my front lawn. Is that right?" "Well, yes," the voice from the public affairs office said. "Is that okay?" "Couldn't they have set their tower up yesterday or the day before if they had wanted to?" "Well, yes," the voice answered, "but that was different." "How so?" "Well, the flight was going fine then. Now it's, you know, more of a news story." "If landing on the moon wasn't enough of a news story for them," Marilyn said, "I don't know why not landing on the moon should be. You tell the networks that they're not going to put one piece of equipment on my property from now through the end of this flight. And if anyone has any problem with that, tell them they can take it up with my husband. I'm expecting him home on Friday." Marilyn Lovell hung up the phone, left the study, and walked back to the kitchen to finish her coffee. There would be no more discussions about broadcast towers for the rest of that day. In the Public Affairs Building at the Manned Spacecraft Center, reporters were a good deal more welcome. But up till now, the press, for the most part, had not been accepting the invitation. The Public Affairs Department actually occupied two buildings. On one side of a gravel courtyard stood a large administration building with offices for the employees, vaults, and library space for the thousands of pages of documents and millions of feet of film that made up the NASA archives, and a small briefing room for impromptu press conferences and announcements. On the other side of the courtyard was a longer, lower building containing a several-hundred-seat auditorium, where NASA held press conferences announcing such headline-making events as the decision to send Apollo 8 to the moon, the selection of the first crew that would land on the moon, and the tentative dates, crew assignments, and landing sites for the missions that would follow. It was also here that people like Chris Kraft, Jim McDivitt, and Sig Sjoberg would be brought for midnight press conferences when something went disastrously wrong on one of those missions. During the months-long layoffs between flights, when the auditorium building went largely unused, it was transformed into a visitor's center, with spent Mercury and Gemini capsules and showcases full of uniforms, helmets, and other artifacts displayed in the lobby surrounding the auditorium itself. During missions, this memorabilia was swept away and replaced by desks and portable typewriters for the use of reporters here to cover the flights. In July 1969, when Apollo 11 was flying, the 693 reporters who had been granted press credentials competed furiously for the limited desk space the agency could provide. For Apollo 12, that November, the competition had eased considerably, with only 363 reporters showing up, and most of them finding a place to sit. For Apollo 13, the number was down to just 250, and the press corps found they had desks to spare. Over the past 10 hours, things had changed. Beginning with the first reports of the accident, dozens of TV, radio, and print reporters who had been patching together their coverage from stories sent over the wire services began showing up at the Space Center's doorstep, requesting clearance and credentials and asking for access to whatever press events NASA now planned to hold. The public affairs officers welcomed the prodigals warmly, issued them security badges, handed them press kits, and showed them to the auditorium, where they were free to choose places to sit among the rapidly filling desks. In mission control, a few hundred yards away from the auditorium building, Brian Duff was well aware of the rapidly gathering media and was pleased they were here. Duff was the Space Center's Director of Public Affairs, and in the 10 months he had held the job, he'd run his department according to a single, overarching rule. When things are going well, tell the media everything they want to know. When things are going badly, tell them even more. This morning, Duff was trying hard to live by the second part of that code. Duff came by his respect for the art of public relations the hard way. Back in 1967, he was working in the agency's public affairs office in Washington when NASA conducted its inquest into the deaths of Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee. In the assessment of even the most partisan NASA supporters, the handling of the Apollo 1 fire was a debacle for the agency. No one complained about the scientific investigation. The spacecraft was autopsied, the causes of the fire were tracked down, and the fixes were made in record time for so knotty an engineering problem. What the agency botched, most people agreed, was the public relations part. Before the Apollo 1 spacecraft had even cooled, on the night of January 27th, both Cape Canaveral and the Manned Spacecraft Center had been closed down and sealed off, and reporters had been told that substantive answers and detailed information would be forthcoming only after a board of inquiry had had a chance to investigate the accident and determine its cause. NASA did quickly appoint such a board, but what escaped no one's notice was the very fact that it was NASA doing the appointing. This was an agency crisis in which grave errors were made by agency officials, and agency men were being assigned to investigate it. The media did not respond well to such self-policing. Within days, Bill Hines, the Washington Star's space reporter, whom NASA had come to view as a sort of windsock for the prevailing public mood, pointedly asked in one of his columns just what the agency foxes were doing guarding their own henhouse. A congressional subcommittee picked up on Hines' theme, announcing that NASA's investigation into its own mistakes would not be sufficient to set the problem to rest, and that the House of Representatives would soon conduct hearings of its own. The Senate went even further, planning yet another inquiry which would, according to Minnesota Senator Walter Mondale, investigate the possible criminal negligence of the nation's space agency. Ultimately, nothing even remotely criminal was uncovered, but the episode took its toll. By the time the Apollo spacecraft was repaired and a new crew was ready to fly, the agency found it had squandered most of the public relations capital it had accumulated over a decade. In 1969, Julian Scheer, the public affairs director who had helped lift the agency to the heights of popularity it enjoyed before the fire, only to see so much of his work undone by the administrators who conducted the fire investigation, left his post, and Brian Duff was appointed to take his place. Duff moved to fix things fast. In the event of future emergencies, the new director proposed, and the agency bosses agreed, NASA's doors would remain open, and the press's questions would be answered without delay. Within hours of an accident, a press conference would be held to announce just how much the agency knew and when they expected to know more. Most dramatically, two more flight controller consoles would be installed in mission control, up in the glassed-in VIP viewing gallery at the rear of the room. During a mission, these would be manned around the clock by pool reporters of the media's own choosing, who would be able to dial up the same data, the same backroom channels, the same flight director's conversations that were available to the controllers themselves, and report what they learned to the world outside. Duff was pleased with the changes, but until last night, until the early morning hours of today, actually, he had not had a chance to see how they worked. So far, he was satisfied. The Kraft-McDivitt-Schoberg press conference had been convened at 12:20 Houston time, just over 3 hours after Jack Swigert first reported that his command module had a problem. The additional media had begun arriving shortly after that and had been promptly informed of the dates and times for the announcements that would follow. Already, Glenn Lunny was preparing for the next such event, a routine change of shift briefing when his black team went off console at around 8 o'clock this morning. As day dawned in Houston and the public affairs auditorium was being readied for Lunny, Duff himself was in mission control. Like the newly plugged-in pool reporters in the VIP gallery, the public affairs officers had their own console with which they, too, could monitor the flight. Unlike the pool reporters, their console was down on the floor of mission control itself, in the left-hand corner of the fourth and last row. And, unlike the pool reporters, the public affairs officers could use their console to do more than simply call up data and eavesdrop on conversations. Throughout the flight, the officer on duty would patch into the air-to-ground channel and provide a running commentary of what was being discussed, translating the technical chatter in the half-whispered tones of a TV sports reporter covering a golf match. It was this communications feed, with the voices of the Capcom and the astronauts overlaid with the voice of the public affairs commentator, that would be sent to the networks and broadcast to the nation. The public affairs officers had been doing this part of their job since well before Duff's arrival, since 1961, in fact, going by the successive names Mercury Control, Gemini Control, and now Apollo Control. Today, the soothing public affairs voice would be more important than it had ever been. And Duff was on hand behind the console to make sure things went well. This is Apollo Control at 67 hours, 23 minutes. Terry White, the officer on duty, was saying this morning, Flight Director Glenn Lunny is still in mission control, and we have no idea exactly when he'll be able to break away for a briefing at this time. So far, we're still leaning toward a PC plus two burn at 79 hours and 27 minutes into the mission, or about 8:40 tonight. We are about 9 hours from loss of signal when the spacecraft will disappear behind the moon. But at the moment, Apollo 13 is stable. We will keep you advised as the situation changes and as Flight Director Lunny becomes available. Terry White clicked off, and the air-to-ground babble once again filled the loop. Aquarius, Houston, Jack Glausner could be heard to be saying. The latest tracking data shows your eventual paracynthian to be holding somewhere around 136 miles, so the trajectory you have is still good. Over. Lausma's message was clear and comprehensible, but the voices coming down from Apollo 13 were a different matter. When Jim Lovell, or maybe Fred Hayes, or maybe Jack Swigert, it was impossible to determine, answered Lausma, his voice seemed to be disintegrating into loud crackles across the expanse of space. Hello, Houston, Aquarius, someone from the ship said. Say again. We say you're holding at 136 nautical miles. Jack, we're getting a lot of background noise. The voice from Aquarius called. Can you read us? Jim, you're readable through the noise, but just barely, Lausma answered. INCO is checking out what we can do about it here. Roger, the voice that evidently belonged to Lovell said. Standing by. There was a scratchy pause for several seconds, then Lausma's voice reappeared. Aquarius, Houston, the Capcom called out. Is it any better now? This is Aquarius, Lovell said back through the static. Negative. A long period of hissing noise filled the line as the Inco, down in the second row, consulted with his back room. The problem, whatever it was nettlesome, but certainly not life-threatening. At the Public Affairs Console, however, Duff was uneasy. Across the country, most viewers were turning on their televisions for the first time since hearing of the accident last night, and the deterioration in communications from the sick, power-poor ship was alarming. He let the hissing play out for a minute or so, then nudged White. Phil, he told him, talk, repeat yourself if you have to, but don't go silent. Silence sounds like we've gone dead altogether. This is Apollo Control, White said. We expect communications to improve a bit after the third stage of the Saturn V crashes into the lunar surface. The radio frequency the stage is transmitting on is giving us a little interference, but after the impact later today, that should stop. Duff smiled with at least passing relief. It didn't really matter what explanation White was offering, as long as he was offering something. It wasn't much, but it should at least keep the nation, and more important, the press corps, from feeling as if they were being kept in the dark. An in-the-dark press corps could turn into a surly press corps, and a surly press corps could turn on you in an eye blink. Today, Duff knew, he would need the friendship of the media more than he ever had before. In the cockpit of the distant and drifting Aquarius, Jim Lovell was at least as concerned about his air-to-ground communications as Brian Duff was, but for different reasons. For all Terry White's attempts at on-air candor, he had told only part of the story. It was true that the empty third stage of the Saturn V booster, hurtling toward an impact on the moon, where it was supposed to jolt the seismometer left behind by Apollo 12, was playing havoc with Aquarius's radio. The Saturn stage, known within NASA as the S-4B, and the LEM did transmit on the same frequency. But since the lunar module was not intended to be fired up and flying free until after the booster had made its crash landing, radio interference between the two vehicles never seemed as if it would be a problem. Now, with Aquarius handling all the voice communications between the crew and the Earth, and the S-4B trying to shout the crew down on the same narrow broadcast band, air-to-ground conversation was being periodically garbled. Making matters worse, the backup communications systems, which ordinarily could cut through some of the clutter, were not operating as they should. As soon as the descent engine had been shut down after the free return burn, NASA sent the crew orders to switch off some of their non-essential equipment in order to conserve energy until the PC-plus-2 burn of Aquarius's descent engine later tonight. Most of the LEM's antennas and much of its secondary communications hardware were among the systems sacrificed. And as each circuit breaker controlling the selected equipment was taken offline, the air-to-ground communications deteriorated more and more. By the time all the switch throwing was complete, Lovell found himself operating on but a single antenna at a time, continually shifting to whichever one seemed to be carrying the clearest signal and banking his spacecraft around to give it the clearest shot at Earth. Houston, this is Aquarius. Lovell shouted through the static in his headset shortly after White's last on-air transmission. The comm is very, very, very noisy right now. Are you reading this? Aquarius, Houston, Lausma shouted back. Copy that. It's noisy on our end, too. Stand by while we think about it. Houston, Aquarius, Lovell shouted again, tweaking his thrusters and shifting the ship a few degrees to port. I'm unable to make out your transmission. Jim, Houston, Lausma shouted back. We're barely able to make you out either. Stand by. Lovell pressed his headset further into his ear and closed his eyes. Can either of you guys figure out what he just said? He asked, turning to his right to consult Hayes. Barely, said Hayes. I think he's saying he can't hear you. Well, hell, Lovell said. I had a pretty good idea of that already. Aquarius, Houston, Lausma suddenly crackled in the crew's headsets, causing all three to jump. Go ahead, Houston, Lovell said. At the moment, it sounds like we have a slightly better downlink. How do you read us? Still a lot of noise on this end. Okay, we've got a suggestion, Lausma said. Recommend you push in the power amplifier circuit breaker on panel 16. Over. Lovell nodded to Hayes, who pushed the appropriate button. Nothing changed in his headset. Houston, Aquarius, he called to the ground. We've still got the noise. All right, Lausma said. We're going to try to improve your comm and telemetry by temporarily breaking lock and reacquiring. We'll be out of contact for a few minutes, and you may hear some noise in your headset. Couldn't be any more noise than what we're getting now, Lovell said. Lausma clicked off the air. and the intermittent static was replaced by a loud, steady hum. Lovell pushed his earpiece an inch or two forward, allowing it to buzz away from his ear. The pause gave the commander a few moments to think, and what he was thinking about was sleep. The sun that was rising across the central time zone shone only spottily on the docked pair of Apollo 13 moon ships. With the engine bell of the LEM pointing back toward Earth, sunlight flowed through the commander's window, and the astronauts found themselves awash in daylight. But when the wobbles in the spacecraft's attitude moved it a few degrees, they were plunged into darkness. These abrupt transitions from day to night did not generally bother Lovell. On the way to the moon, the passive thermal control roll that kept the spacecraft evenly heated all around caused the sun to strobe continually in and out of the LEMs and command module's portholes. After just a day or so in translunar drift, the astronauts got accustomed to the constant flickering and went about their sleep-wake-work-rest schedules as if the sun were rising and setting outside their craft, just as it did outside their homes in Houston. As long as the crew maintained that schedule, NASA's flight surgeons had learned, their circadian cycles would remain largely undisturbed. By 7 o'clock on Tuesday morning, however, those cycles had been bollocksed up but good. According to the original mission plan, the most recent sleep shift for the crew was to have begun at 10 o'clock last night and run until about an hour ago. Even on a routine flight, no one expected the pilots to sleep a full 8 hours. The almost total lack of physical exertion in space and the almost constant output of adrenaline that accompanied the business of flying to the moon made 5 or 6 hours of sack time the most the medics could hope for. Those 5 or 6 hours, however, were absolutely essential if a crew that was flying even a nominal mission was going to make it through their day without making some serious and perhaps disastrous mistake. A crew that was flying a less than nominal mission would need even more rest. By the time the free return burn was complete, the flight surgeons had prepared a revised work rest schedule that the crew was to begin following immediately. Hayes, it was decided, would get some sleep first, retreating alone to the command module from about the 63-hour mark, or 4 a.m., to about 69 hours, or 10 a.m. Odyssey had no oxygen of its own to sustain even a sleeping man, but with the hatch open between the two ships, more than enough atmosphere would float up from the lunar module. While Hayes slept, Swigert and Lovell would stay on watch, using the time to power down the backup communications system and all the other hardware NASA wanted taken offline. When Hayes woke, he would eat breakfast, confer with his crewmates about any problems that had developed while he slept, and take the helm alone while Lovell and Swigert retired to the command module from 70 hours to 76 hours. The entire crew would be back on duty by 5 p.m., in plenty of time to prep for the PC plus 2 burn at 8:40. Almost as soon as Lausma radioed up the flight surgeon's instructions, it became clear that sleeping and waking according to the medic's schedule would not be an easy matter. As Hayes floated up the tunnel and into Odyssey, he was stunned at what he found. The temperature in the lifeless ship had been an already chilly 58 degrees when the crew abandoned it, but in the few hours they had been gone, the thermometer had fallen even further. When he poked his head through the top of the command module's cone, he could clearly see his breath condensing in front of him. The crew's two-piece beta cloth jumpsuits were not designed for warmth in the constant 72-degree atmosphere the command module was supposed to maintain, and Hayes immediately wrapped his arms around himself and pushed off in the direction of his couch to zip himself into his sleeping bag. However, the thin cloth cocoons the astronauts used during sleep periods were intended merely as restraints to prevent a weightless arm or leg from drifting up during the night and striking a switch or circuit breaker. Hayes pulled out his bag, slipped inside it, and settled as deeply into his couch as he could. But even swaddled in the extra layer of fabric, he found himself lying shivering and awake, his body pressed up against the cold metal bulkhead of the spacecraft. As troubling as the dropping temperature in Odyssey was the noise, the open hatch between the two ships allowed not only the ambient atmosphere from the lunar module to flow into the command module, but also the ambient sounds. If the churning of the LEM's coolant systems and the bumping of its thrusters weren't hard enough for a sleeping man to tune out, the shouted conversations of Lovell and Swigert fighting to be heard over the staticky comm channels were. Hayes, who had a reputation in the astronaut corps for his ability to sleep nearly anywhere under nearly any conditions, fought gamely to shut out the din from next door. But finally, at 6 in the morning, less than 2 hours after his 6-hour sleep cycle had begun, he gave up, wriggled out of his sleeping bag, and floated down through the tunnel to the LEM. "That's it?" Lovell asked, glancing at his watch as Hayes appeared between him and Swigert, drifting upside down through Aquarius's roof. "It's too cold up there," Hayes muttered, reaching for one of the food packets Swigert had carried over earlier and tearing it open with only passing interest. "Too cold and too noisy. You guys can give it a try, but I wouldn't count on getting much rest." Now, at 7 a.m., in the silence of the temporary communications blackout, Lovell closed his eyes and felt the fatigue seep in. On the ground, he knew, Gerald Griffin's gold team would just be replacing Glenn Lunny's black team, the fresh controllers coming off at least a partial night's sleep, taking over the consoles from the bleary controllers coming off a full night's work. At the Capcom console, even Jack Lausma, who had worked a double shift beginning yesterday afternoon, would at last be handing off to astronaut Joe Kerwin. Lovell was glad a new group would be coming on, but fresh as Griffin's men might be this morning, they were going to be working with a trio of astronauts who would be sleepier, and no doubt testier, than any crew they had ever worked with before. Lovell told himself he would try to keep everything percolating as steadily as possible, but the ground was going to have to make some allowances. "Aquarius, Houston," Lausma suddenly crackled in his ear. "How do you read us now?" Lovell jerked at the sound and opened his eyes. "We still read you with a lot of static," he said wearily. "The noise seems to indicate..." "I didn't copy your last remark, Jim." "I said we still have noise," Lovell said back in a loud, slow voice. "We do too." "Do you want us to remain in this configuration, then?" Lovell asked. "Stay there for the next minute or two, Jim," Lausma answered. "Then we'll evaluate it." At this point, to the surprise of no one more than Lovell, the cold and the static and the uncertain advice from the Capcom got to be too much. "I'll tell you what we need," Lovell snapped. "We need you to try to get this squared away. See if you can't report the right procedures here. The whole works before we get all balled up." As chewing outs went, it wasn't much. But in the uninflected atonal context of the air-to-ground loop, it was as close to a harangue as Houston was ever likely to get. Lovell looked to his crewmates, who nodded at him sympathetically. Lausma looked at the men near his console, who responded to him the same way. Both he and Lovell knew that getting the right procedures up to the ship was precisely what the Capcom had been trying to do. And both he and Lovell knew that the commander appreciated that. Lovell, like his own spacecraft late last night, was merely venting, something he'd had good cause to do for the last 10 hours, and something it was about time he did. Lausma looked over his shoulder to Kerwin, who was standing by waiting to relieve him. Now, he decided, might be as good a time as any to give up the microphone. He shrugged, rose, removed his headset, and pulled his chair back for Kerwin. Kerwin plugged his own headphones into the console, sat down, and signed on the air as folksily as he could. "Jim," he called, "how's that calm now?" "Well," Lovell grumbled, recognizing the change in voice and softening his own in response to it, "there's still a lot of background noise." "Okay, we'll look at it some more," Kerwin promised, "but your calm down to us is excellent now." "Roger that," Lovell said flatly and closed his eyes again. The commander didn't say anything more in response to Kerwin's little bucking up. If the communications channel was clear for the present, that was fine, but that fix, like every other fix the ground had come up with so far, was almost certain to be just a passing thing. Before long, Lovell thought, the comm would decay again, along with who knew what other systems. He opened his eyes and glanced out his window at the gray-white, plastery moon that was now less than 40,000 miles away, nearly filling his triangular porthole. According to the original flight plan, today was the day that he and Fred Hayes were supposed to set their lander down on the face of the giant body. That, of course, was now not to be, and for Lovell at least, it probably never would be. He had been out to this celestial neighborhood twice, and he knew he would have little chance of ever coming back. If he and Swigert and Hayes did not make it home, he wondered if anyone at all would ever travel to these parts again. "Fredo," Lovell said, turning to Hayes, "I'm afraid this is going to be the last moon mission for a long time." With Aquarius's microphones switched to Vox, the commander's forlorn observation drifted 200,000 miles into the heart of mission control, and from there, out into the world. Glenn Lunny, still on duty as flight director, was barely paying attention when Jim Lovell made his prediction about the future of lunar exploration. It was a rare moment in any flight when the man who ran the mission did not have at least one ear cocked to the conversations between his astronauts and his Capcom. But with the clouds of static on the air-to-ground loop and the traffic running heavy on the flight director's loop, Lunny had to trust Kerwin to handle the ship-to-shore messages alone. Most of the other men at the other consoles had more freedom to listen in on Kerwin's loop, including Terry White, who was just minutes away from completing his shift at the public affairs station and heading home. White, along with everyone else in Mission Control and the nation, heard Lovell's remark and, along with everyone else in NASA, was jolted by it. For an agency whose lifeblood was funding and whose funding relied on good PR, this was worse than an accidental damn or an inadvertent frappin'. This was a calmly, coldly expressed statement of doubt. Doubt in the mission, doubt in the program, doubt in the agency itself. For NASA, it was profanity of the highest order. Kerwin, a Capcom with otherwise good instincts, reacted to Lovell's inadvertently public remark in the worst possible way. He said nothing. Hoping not to draw attention to the comment, he allowed it to go wholly unacknowledged. Instead, however, it hung heavily in the air, taking on more and more meaning with each passing second. White allowed the silence to continue for several interminable moments and then jumped into the breach. "This is Apollo Control at 68 hours and 13 minutes," he said. "Flight Director Glenn Lunny and four of his flight controllers will soon be on their way to the Public Affairs Building for the news conference. Accompanying Lunny will be Tom Weichel, the Retrofire Officer, Clint Burton, ECOM, Hal Loden, the Control, and Merlin Merritt, the Telmu. An additional participant will be Major General David O. Jones, United States Air Force, who commands the Department of Defense Recovery Forces." White's PR reflexes were good. The words he chose were not just soothing prattle designed to distract listeners at home. Rather, they also served as a sort of plea to the media. "Bear with us," they said. "Work with us. We heard the same thing you did, and we'll be happy to talk to you about it. Just give us all a chance to discuss it together before you put it out in print." Whether the media took White's meaning was unclear, and it would remain unclear until Lunny and his crew sat down with the assembled reporters. For the time being, however, Lunny remained distracted, and was likely to become only more so. Since the moment the pre-dawn free-return burn was completed, the men in the control room had been concentrating most of their energy on one thing, the PC-plus-2 burn, scheduled for 17 hours later. With Lunny on console and Kranz closeted with his Tiger team, Gold Team Flight Director Gerald Griffin and Maroon Team Leader Milt Windler had overseen the effort and, by any measure, managed to accomplish a remarkable amount in an impossibly short time. For the past 4 hours, the two off-duty directors had been patrolling the control room almost as one, stopping at console after console, grilling the men they found there, and collecting whatever ideas they had for the long, complicated burn of a lunar module engine with a 63,000-pound command service module attached. At most of the consoles, the black team member on duty was not alone, but was attended by the gold and maroon team members who worked at the same station and who had been showing up throughout the night. When Griffin and Windler arrived, they moved in opposite directions. Griffin toward the gold controller, whose ideas and talents he knew best, and Windler toward the maroon. Occasionally, the black team member, behind whose chair and out of whose earshot the conversations were supposed to be taking place, would overhear a scrap of the discussion, cover his microphone, and spin around in his seat to correct something the men behind him were saying, or add a technical suggestion of his own. From 3 o'clock to 7 o'clock, the impromptu meetings went on. And by the time the Tuesday morning controllers were ready to relieve the Monday night crew, Griffin and Windler had sketched out 3 different PC-plus-2 scenarios, none of which, they knew, was perfect, but all of which would bring the crew home faster than the trajectory they were following now. As Brian Duff planned his early morning press conference, Glenn Lunny put in his last hour on console, and Fred Hayes arose from the night's sleep he never had. Griffin and Windler sat wearily in the aisle next to the flight director's station, their elbows balanced on their knees and their heads held in their hands, hoping to suggest, if only by their poses, that for just a few minutes they'd like not to be a part of the ongoing buzz in the room. Behind them, Chris Kraft approached and laid a hand on each of their shoulders. The two men turned. "What have we got?" Kraft asked. Griffin and Windler looked at him uncomprehendingly for an instant. "What kind of burn have we got?" Kraft clarified. "Do we know how we want to proceed with this?" "We've got some pretty good ideas," Griffin said. "As far as we can see, we've got 3 options, any one of which should help a lot." "Will they be ready to go in 12 hours?" Kraft asked. "They should be," Griffin said. "Would you be ready to talk about them in an hour?" "What do you mean?" Windler asked. Some people are going to be getting together to discuss all this in the viewing room, and we're going to have to be able to explain things to them as best we can. What people, Chris? Griffin asked. Gilruth, Lowe, McDivitt, Payne, most of the guys at that level, Kraft said. Plus you guys, Deke, Gene, and whoever else you think we might need. Probably a couple dozen people in all. Griffin was more than mildly surprised. Gilruth, of course, was Bob Gilruth, director of the manned spacecraft center. Lowe was George Lowe, the director of spacecraft and flight missions. Payne was Thomas Payne, the administrator of NASA itself. Bringing men like Deke, Kraft, McDivitt, Kranz, and the rest of the flight directors together for a meeting in mission control was one thing. During a mission, people on that rung of the organizational ladder met all the time in and around the control room to discuss various problems and procedures. But the Gilruths, Lowe's, Payne's, and other men on the upper rungs were rarely part of the conferences. These were the big-picture people, the people who relied on Kranz and Kraft and the rest to run the individual missions while they ran the program as a whole. Bringing these men into mission control for a caucus in the soundproof, glassed-in enclosure of the VIP gallery, at once the most private and least private room in the building, was without precedent. It was a gathering of the Council of Agency Elders, the NASA equivalent of a joint session of Congress, and it would take place in full view of an audience of controllers who had never seen so much NASA royalty in one place before. This is going to happen in an hour? Griffin asked. Less than an hour, Kraft said. And before it does, I want to meet with all the flight directors to make sure we've got our ducks in a line. Pull Glenn off console and let's go find a place to talk. Kranz is downstairs with his Tiger team, Windler said. You want us to get him too? Yes, Kraft said, and then reconsidered. No. No, don't. I don't want to disturb him until it's necessary. Let him keep working on the consumables until the meeting itself. Then we'll bring him up. Griffin and Windler nudged Lunny, told him Kraft needed him, and the black team flight director turned his console over to his assistant and followed the three men to a staff support room. When they got there, Kraft closed the door, sat, and inclined his head wordlessly to his controllers, inviting them to tell him what they knew. Lunny knew little more than Kraft did, so he deferred to Griffin, who began to walk Kraft through the three burns they had just finished developing. Kraft did not need the basic science explained to him. He knew the language of the Fidos and Guidos and the flight directors who oversaw them. What he really wanted were the consequences of each maneuver, what the risks were, what the advantages were, how each one might affect the odds of bringing his astronauts back alive. Griffin spoke candidly and economically, and Kraft listened, nodding occasionally but saying nothing. When the flight director was done, Kraft went to work, raising questions, raising objections, poking at Griffin's projections, challenging his estimates, and on the whole, trying to anticipate the grilling that would be forthcoming from the men in the VIP room. Griffin and Windler answered Kraft's concerns as best they could, and Lunny, hearing most of this for the first time, nodded in agreement. Finally, after an hour, Kraft seemed satisfied, opened the door, and prepared to lead his group over to the viewing gallery. Before he could, however, Griffin stopped him. "You know, Chris," he said, "I'd sure feel more comfortable if we all weren't going in there alone." "Who else do you need?" Kraft asked. "Well, it's my Fido and Retro who crunched all this data." "Who are they?" "Chuck Dietrich and Dave Reed," said Griffin. "If I had my choice, I wouldn't go anywhere without my numbers guys." "Go get them," Kraft said, "and get Gene, too." Kraft waited while Griffin fetched Dietrich, Reed, and Gene Kranz, and when they returned, the men made their way together over to the VIP area. When they arrived, the tableau that greeted them was an imposing one. The pool reporters manning the press consoles in the front right corner of the gallery had been cleared away, and in the front left corner, two dozen or so men were silently waiting. A few had settled into the movie theater seats, but most were standing in the aisles, perched against the backs of seats or leaning against the walls. Through the floor-to-ceiling window at the front of the gallery, the entire sweep of mission control was visible, and now and then a flight controller could be seen stealing a glance at the silent council sealed behind the glass. Kraft wasted little time getting things started. "In about 12 hours," he began, "we're going to need to execute our PC-plus-2 burn. Our objective will be to get the crew home as fast as possible while stretching our consumables as far as possible. The flight directors have come up with some possible burns, and since it's Jerry's team that worked out so many of the numbers, I'll let him explain them." Griffin stepped forward, cleared his throat, and began to describe, slowly and deliberately, the procedures he had just gone over much more quickly with Kraft. As Griffin explained it, and as he was sure the men in the room realized, the most precious consumable Apollo 13 had to work with was not oxygen or power or lithium hydroxide. It was time. Get back to Earth quickly enough, and the problems with all the other consumables will take care of themselves. The obvious answer, then, was to burn the LEM's descent engine at full throttle for as long as the fuel supply would allow, increasing the ship's velocity until it could be increased no more. But the obvious answer was not necessarily the best answer. Burning the engine until it ran dry would leave almost no fuel for subsequent mid-course corrections, which might well be needed. The ship would be covering more than 250,000 miles, and the slightest error in the initial trajectory would thus be magnified many times over. The ascent stage of the lunar module did have an engine of its own, and in an emergency, it could always be fired. But in order to do so, the crew would have to jettison the descent stage first, and it was the descent stage that contained most of the lander's batteries and oxygen tanks. The length and strength of the burn, Griffin went on, would determine not only the crew's fuel reserves and their transit time back to Earth, but what body of water they would plop into when they got here. With only some of the Earth's oceans approachable from space, and only one of those oceans, the Pacific, equipped with adequate recovery vessels, the choices were limited. The three different maneuvers Griffin and Windler had come up with would address these problems in three different ways. The first burn, Griffin explained, would be a long one. Pushing the descent throttle all the way to the full position, Lovell would leave it there for more than 6 minutes before shutting the engine down. This maneuver, which for simplicity's sake Griffin called the superfast burn, would put the crew down in the Atlantic Ocean on Thursday morning, just 36 hours from the scheduled PC plus 2 time later tonight. Such an early return would be well within even the most pessimistic estimates of the LEM's projected lifetime, and for that reason alone was very attractive. But the superfast burn would also come at a price. Not only would it use an enormous amount of fuel and aim the astronauts toward a patch of ocean where the Navy had not so much as a fishing trawler presently stationed, it would also require them to make the entire trip home without a key part of their spacecraft. In order to reduce the mass of the docked ships enough to make such a go-for-broke maneuver effective, Lovell would have to jettison the now useless service module. To be sure, Griffin explained, the flight directors did not harbor any illusions that this presumably blast-damaged part of the ship could be brought back to life. But they were nevertheless reluctant to part with it. The service module, as the room of administrators knew, fit snugly over the base of the command module, protecting the heat shield, which in turn would protect the crew, during their fiery re-entry through the atmosphere. Nobody had ever conducted experiments to find out what would happen to a heat shield that had spent a day and a half in the deep freeze of space, and now might not be the time to run the test. Complicating matters, even if an ordinary heat shield could survive such frigid conditions, it was possible that Apollo 13's was not ordinary. If the accident that destroyed the oxygen tanks had put even a hairline crack in the thick epoxy resin face of the shield, the ultra-low temperatures of sunless space could split it wide open. Still, Griffin summed up, if consumables proved to be an insurmountable problem, the superfast return might be worth considering. The next burn would be a little slower than the superfast burn, conserving some fuel while adding only a few hours to the homeward trip. The biggest advantage of this procedure was that the added transit time would allow the Earth to make another quarter turn, presenting a different face to the re-entering spacecraft and permitting it to splash down in the heavily trafficked Pacific. The biggest disadvantage was that, like the high-speed return, this one would require jettisoning the dead service module. The final burn option was the slowest and least dramatic of all. Keeping Odyssey's service module in place, Lovell would fire Aquarius's descent engine for only 4.5 minutes, and only part of that time at full throttle. Like the medium burn, this more modest maneuver would aim the crew for a splashdown in the friendly Pacific. Unlike the medium burn, however, it would get them there not midday Thursday, but midday Friday, more than 3 days from now, or only 10 hours faster than they would arrive without any PC plus 2 burn at all. If the heat shield and the recovery were the only considerations, Griffin concluded, this burn would certainly be the way to go. But when consumables were figured into the equation, things could get a little sticky. Griffin finished his presentation and stepped back to allow his audience of agency superiors to make their choice. Instantly, hands went up. What, someone wanted to know, was the likelihood that the heat shield was damaged? Probably low, Griffin answered, but if there was a crack, the probability of losing the crew could be 100%. How far, someone else asked, could the consumables be stretched? Too early to tell at the moment, Griffin admitted. Kranz at his side agreed. What, someone else wondered, was the precise delta V and the precise burn time for all three maneuvers? Dietrich and Reed stepped forward and passed around their handwritten notes, explaining the meaning of each scribbled digit. For nearly an hour, the men in the room debated their options as Kraft and his crew of flight directors watched. Deke Slayton, as the chief astronaut and thus the chief advocate for all the other astronauts, argued strongly for the fastest burn, and several other voices soon joined his. But more numerous, and soon overwhelming, were the voices arguing for the slowest burn. Yes, consumables were going to be a problem. But weren't Kranz and the Tiger team and the legendary John Aaron working on that? Yes, it would be difficult to explain to the media and the world at large why a crew in extremis was being kept in space for even an hour, never mind a day, longer than necessary. But wouldn't it be harder to explain why that same crew was flown most of the way home without fuel and dropped through the atmosphere on a busted heat shield into an ocean where the Navy had to scramble to put ships? Kraft and his flight directors let the arguments play out and watched, satisfied, as the men in the room settled on the slowest alternative. It was the choice the flight directors themselves had preferred, and it was the one they had hoped the administrators would prefer. Now, as the arguments began to gel into a consensus, Chris Kraft transformed the consensus into a decision. "So it's agreed," he summed up. "At 79 hours and 27 minutes, there will be an 850-foot-per-second burn for 4.5 minutes, aiming for a Pacific splash at 142 hours. If all goes well, Apollo 13 will be home by Friday afternoon." The men in the room nodded, and almost simultaneously rose and began to move toward the doors. As the flight controllers at the consoles peered over their shoulders for one last peek at the dispersing administrators, Gerald Griffin turned to Glenn Lunny. "What do you say we quit talking about this thing," he said, "and go see if we can't do it?" Chapter 9. Tuesday, April 14th, 2 p.m. When Gene Kranz walked into the VIP gallery hours after the PC Plus 2 meeting broke up, the two reporters at the media consoles did not dream of trying to talk to him. A greener journalist would have. A greener journalist would have been crazy not to. When the man at the center of a maelstrom like Apollo 13 appears, unaccompanied, in your midst, with virtually no other newsman in sight to compete for his attention, you do what every reportorial instinct you have screams at you to do. You buttonhole him for a prediction or an impression or at least a space-filling quote. But the reporters at the consoles knew better. When Kranz appeared in the VIP gallery in the middle of a flight, he was not here to talk. He was here to sleep. Ever since the Gemini program, when NASA began conducting missions that ran for 4 or 8 or 14 days, the agency medics had requested, and the agency bosses had provided, on-site sleeping quarters for flight controllers who needed to be on call around the clock. The accommodations weren't much, no more than a small, windowless room in the mission control building with a shower, a sink, and 2 Army-style beds. But for controllers accustomed to sneaking off to an empty conference room if they needed a nap between shifts, it was unimaginable luxury. The little bedroom was christened with great fanfare, and as soon as the next mission flew, controllers clamored for the chance to lay claim to it. Those first few who tried it out quickly wished they hadn't. The room was directly off a hallway with lots of foot traffic passing by and lots of unceasing conversation. Most of the sound leaked through the plasterboard walls, and the little bit that didn't flooded in whenever the door was opened. The door itself had a hydraulic closing device that had apparently never been adjusted properly. When someone entered or exited, the door would groan open reluctantly and then slam shut with a sleep-shattering bang. Even the shower's pipes banged and groaned noisily. Despite all this, on nearly every flight, there were half a dozen or so over-dedicated controllers, including Gene Kranz, who insisted on staying at the center full-time. So, competition for the two cots was usually keen. When lunar missions started becoming almost routine, however, and fewer people worked consecutive shifts, Kranz had sworn off the noisy controller's bedroom for good. If he needed sleep, he decided, he would retreat to the VIP gallery, select a seat in one of the far shadowed corners, and catch as long a cat nap as the schedule permitted. On Tuesday afternoon, Kranz, who had been working for more than 24 unbroken hours, decided to allow himself a break, and with a nod to the reporters working the VIP consoles, he settled into a cushioned chair. He knew that the nap he could steal would be a decidedly short one. From the time Kranz turned his console over to Glenn Lunny late last night, he had been shut up in room 210 with his Tiger team, poring over his strip charts and consumables profiles. Although the story the data told him was not a happy one, on the LEM side of the room, the picture was at least somewhat promising. After quickly conducting the consumables calculations that followed Aquarius's power-up, Bob Hesselmeyer, the white team Telmu, reviewed the numbers with Kranz, and then, unlike most of the members of the white team, was sent back to the consoles. Hesselmeyer was a good Telview, but he was also the youngest one assigned to the Apollo 13 rotation. For the LEM consumables work that had to be done, Kranz preferred Bill Peters, a Telview on Jerry Griffin's Gold Team, who had worked every flight since Gus Grissom and John Young's Gemini 3 in 1965. The Tiger Team leader's trust in Peters turned out to be well-placed. After sitting down with Kranz for half the morning and conferring with Tom Kelly at Grumman for the other half, Bill Peters made remarkable strides in solving Aquarius's consumables crisis. Tackling the water and power problem first, the two resources in shortest supply, Peters was able to economize even more than Kelly and Hesselmeyer had thought feasible. According to the profiles Peters and his electrical specialist came up with, it appeared possible to run the LEM, which normally needed about 55 amps of current to stay alive, on a starvation ration of just 12 amps. A fully powered LEM had about 1,800 amps to play with, divided among four batteries in the descent stage and two in the ascent. 12 amps wasn't much compared to this, but after factoring out that power demand over the time it would take the crew to come home and setting aside a small quantity of buffer power in case of further emergencies, Peters didn't figure he could afford to use much more. The more electricity the Telview saved, the more water he would save as well. And Peters' strict battery diet thus conserved gallons of that scarce commodity as well. All of the frugality he proposed came at a price, however. The partial shutdown of systems the LEM engineers had ordered between the free return burn and the PC plus two was nothing compared to what Peters had planned for the long coast home. As soon as the speed-up maneuver was completed at 8:40 tonight, he would order the disconnection of virtually every electricity-consuming component the lunar module had, with the exception of three: the communications system and one of its antennas, the cabin fan, which would circulate the available oxygen, and the water glycol coolant pumps to keep the temperature down in the other two systems. Taken offline would be the computer, guidance system, cabin heater, docking radar, landing radar, instrument panel displays, and hundreds of other pieces of hardware. All of the sacrificed equipment could be powered back up in the event that it was needed for subsequent burns or other maneuvers, but to the extent possible, it would remain off for the entire return trip. To be sure, there were gaps in Peters' draconian power-down plan. For one thing, the already uncomfortable LEM promised to become even more uncomfortable with the loss of instruments and cabin lights plunging the cockpit into darkness and the loss of heat-generating instruments driving the chilly temperature down even more. For another thing, no one had yet solved the problem of how to scrub the cabin air free of carbon dioxide without fresh lithium hydroxide canisters to absorb the noxious gas. Perhaps most troubling, the LEM would have to provide power for more than just its own systems. Hubble, Swigert, and Hayes abandoned Odyssey. Their dying command module had begun cannibalizing one of its three re-entry batteries, automatically tapping into it for power after the three fuel cells expired. In order for the ship to be powered up again for re-entry, that battery would have to be recharged, and the only place to get the juice was from the already hard-pressed electrical system of Aquarius. Even as Peters was trying to figure out how to keep his spacecraft alive for the half-week that lay ahead, John Aaron came by to borrow some amps for his own sick ship. "Bill," Aaron said, buttonholing Peters in a corner of room 210 and speaking to him in his most winning Oklahoma drawl, "you know I can't run that command module on 2.5 batteries." "I know it, John," Peters said. "And you know I have to get it from you." "I know that, too. How much can you give me?" "How much do you need?" Peters asked warily. "Those are just little bitty batteries you've got in there. You don't need too much, do you?" "We've got to top off the depleted one at about 50 amps," Aaron explained. "And when they abandoned ship, it was down to 16. So I'm going to have to ask you for about 34. Peters thought a moment. 34. 34, I could do. But you're actually asking me for a lot more than that. My chargers and umbilicals only have an efficiency of about 30 or 40%. To pump 34 amps all the way over to you is going to cost me about 100. "I know it, Bill," Aaron said with genuine sympathy. "Can you do it anyway?" Peters contemplated his 1,800 available amps and ran some quick mental math. "Yeah," he said cautiously. "I expect that I can." On the command module side of the room, things were even more complicated, and Aaron's ability to negotiate and cajole was going to be even more essential. What was consuming most of the lead ECOM's time was not how he hoped to top off his batteries, but how in the world he expected to be able to power up Odyssey, whether he had Peters' extra amps or not. Ordinarily, the process of putting an Apollo command module online was extraordinarily costly in terms of power and in terms of time. Before a launch, pad technicians usually needed up to a full day to accomplish the feat, using thousands of amps of ground power to warm up each system and check its vital signs before declaring it fit for flight. The process was painstaking, but with unlimited amps and unlimited hours at their disposal, NASA engineers preferred to be as careful as possible. With Apollo 13, Aaron would not have this luxury. He and Kranz ran some preliminary power projections and came up with some disquieting numbers. Assuming Odyssey's third battery was indeed successfully topped off, Aaron would have merely 2 hours of juice to play with when the time came for reactivating the spacecraft. For an engineer schooled in NASA's hyper-cautious ways after Apollo 1, this seemed like recklessness of the highest order, but Aaron believed the job could be pulled off. What concerned him most was how he was going to explain things to the flight controllers who oversaw the spacecraft's systems. In principle, every man in room 210 understood that engineering corners would have to be cut if the command module was going to make it home intact. In practice, however, nobody wanted to think that it would be his corner that would be affected, and Aaron did not relish breaking the news to them. With Kranz standing by, he gathered the command module controllers around the conference table and spoke with a down-home diffidence that was equal parts prairie manners and calculated salesmanship. "Fellows," he said, "I know I'm not supposed to know about all your systems, so bear with me and correct me when I make a mistake, but I think I have some ideas how we can get this ship online when the time comes. Now, the way I see it, we're going to have about 2 hours of battery time to go from a cold stop to a full power-up." "John," Bill Strabel, the guidance and navigation officer, said, "you can't do it in that time." "Well, now that's what I thought, Bill," Aaron said, chuckling at his own wrong-headedness. "But I think if we're willing to take a few shortcuts, we just might be able to pull it off." "Sure, you can pull it off," Strabel said, "but can you pull it off safely?" "I think just maybe we can," Aaron said. "I've got a few ideas here. Just rough stuff, nothing set in stone, but maybe if we all took a look at them, we could all flesh them out a little bit." Almost apologetically, Aaron produced a sheaf of strip chart paper crowded with crayon markings. The scribbles ran on for page after page, representing dozens of projections, predictions, and computations Aaron had worked out with the help of Jim Kelly, his electrical systems specialist. From even a glance, it was clear that this was not rough stuff. These were not a few ideas. This was a brutally realistic, exhaustively considered breakdown of exactly how much power and how much time the ship had to work with, whether the controllers wanted to hear about it or not. Aaron knew the numbers were good, and the controllers, he suspected, knew it too. He passed his papers around, let the controllers digest them, and the first of what promised to be dozens of hours of negotiating, bartering, and dickering began. The controllers would have objections, and they would have ideas, but what they wouldn't have was much time. According to the trajectory the crew was now following, Apollo 13 would collide with the Earth's atmosphere in less than 72 hours. Assuming the PC-plus-2 burn went as planned later tonight, that number would be slashed to 62. If Aaron didn't have a power-up checklist put together within 48 hours at the latest, the steely-eyed missile man was in real danger of losing his first crew. Gerald Griffin's gold team was not thinking about consumables. They would eventually, Griffin knew, like all the other teams. The gold team had days of resource management ahead of them. But right now, they didn't have to concern themselves with that. Griffin had been in charge of this flight for more than 5 hours now, and so far things had been relatively quiet. It was on Kranz's white team watch that Apollo 13's tank-blowing accident had taken place, on Lunny's black team watch that the power down and free return had been executed, and on Windler's maroon team watch that the PC-plus-2 would have to be tried. There was talk that Kranz's tiger team, formerly white team, might come out of isolation long enough to commandeer the consoles for tonight's PC-plus-2 maneuver, then turn them back over to Windler. And if that was what Kranz wanted, nobody would deny him. But whether it was the Tiger team or the Maroon team, that would follow Griffin on console, the Gold team leader's assignment was clear. Keep the ship functioning, help it avoid any further technical crises, and make sure it was properly prepped for the PC-plus-2 burn. So far, Griffin's group was performing all of its jobs well, with the distinct exception of the last one. The earlier efforts of Lunny's black team to fine-tune Aquarius's platform despite the debris cloud surrounding the ship had met with failure. And when Lunny had decided to attempt the free return burn relying solely on the alignment transferred from the command module, The men in the control room had simply shrugged and hoped for the best. That burn, they knew, would be short, and any errors in the alignment of the platform would not be magnified too much. For the PC Plus 2, however, things would be different. Not only was the scheduled burn a sustained one, more than 9 times longer than the mere engine burp that had placed the crew back on their free return path, but it would also take place close to 18 hours later. Guidance platforms had a tendency to drift over time, and even if the coordinates Lovell had transferred from Odyssey at 10 last night were still good at 2:43 in the morning, they would almost certainly have deteriorated by 8:10 the next night. For much of the past several hours, Griffin and his gold team had thus been in constant touch with the technicians in the simulator room across the Space Center campus, where Charlie Duke and John Young were trying to come up with some alignment solutions the black team guidance officers hadn't. So far, the results were not encouraging. With star maps projected on the simulator's windows and an additional light source added to represent the sun, the two pilots had cartwheeled their Mach LEM through every simulated orientation they could think of, trying to move Aquarius's windows deep enough into shadow to black out the debris cloud and allow the true stars to appear. No matter which way they turned, though, the ersatz sun continued to wash around the LEM, which set the debris twinkling and made even approximate star sightings impossible. As noon gave way to afternoon and the latest gloomy reports filtered back from the simulator building, Chuck Dietrich, Dave Reed, and Ken Russell, Griffin's Retro, Fido, and Guido, sat slumped at their consoles in the front row of Mission Control, utterly stuck.
"So, what's our game plan here?" Reed asked his two colleagues, pushing back from his center console and looking left toward Dietrich and right toward Russell. "What do you fellas propose to try next?"
"Dave," Dietrich said, "I'm open to suggestions."
"I assume we're giving up on the stars," Russell said.
"If we can't see them," said Dietrich, "we can't fly by them."
"I suppose we could always wait until we get behind the moon," Russell said. "Once they're in shadow, the debris won't be lit so much."
"That cuts things pretty close, doesn't it?" Reed responded. "They've only got half an hour of shadow and only 2 hours after that till the burn. If something goes wrong, they won't have any time to get it right."
"Look," Russell said, "let's face it. The only thing we can see out there is the thing that's causing us all the trouble in the first place, the sun."
"Well, shoot," Dietrich said. "Long as it's there, why don't we just use it? It's a star, isn't it? The computer recognizes it, doesn't it? No matter how much debris you have, once you go looking for the sun, you're sure not going to mistake it for anything else."
He looked at Reed and Russell, and the two men looked skeptically back at him. Ordinarily, a fine alignment of a guidance platform was a fantastically accurate thing. With the bowl of the celestial sky stretching around the ship for 360 degrees in three dimensions, a solitary star was as close as you could get to the platonic ideal of a single geometric point. Infinitely small, infinitely precise, an infinite number of them making up a single degree of arc. Take sightings on a few of these bright cosmic pinpricks, and you could torque your platform to a level of accuracy that virtually eliminated any margin of navigational error. Using the sun instead of the stars was an entirely different matter. First of all, the thing was huge, measuring 865,400 miles in diameter, and located only 93 million miles away from Earth, a mere arm's length by cosmic standards. The local star sits in the sky like a huge white blob, spreading across a full half degree of the heavens. Within its big, bright face, dozens of pinpoint stars could fit. What Dietrich was proposing, Reed and Russell instantly understood, was not to try to use this gross target to align the platform all over again, but rather simply to check the alignment the ship already had. If the astronauts instructed the guidance platform to go looking for the sun, and the platform drove the spacecraft, and specifically its alignment telescope, to within, say, a degree or so of where the neighborhood star actually was, they would know that Aquarius had its bearings straight and that its platform could be trusted when it came time for the burn. But no sooner did Dietrich propose his plan than he himself began to have doubts.
"Of course, we are talking about a pretty fat target here, aren't we?" he said.
"Very fat," Russell said.
"And what about the optics?" Dietrich asked. "You put the sun in an eyepiece where only a star is supposed to go, and you're going to fry your eye right out."
"They've got filters to take care of that part," Russell said, "but I'm still not crazy about the whole idea. This is a hip pocket procedure we're trying, fellas. It's fine in a simulator, but do you really want to rely on it in flight?"
"Not especially," said Dietrich, "but do we really have any other choice?"
Russell and Reed looked at each other.
"Not a one," Russell said.
2 rows up at the flight director's console, Griffin was keeping an eye on his man in the front row and could see that they were deeply involved in discussing something.
He dearly hoped that that something was an alignment plan. Like every other flight director, Griffin kept a log at his console in which he made entries when key mission milestones arrived and passed. So far, the space he had expected to fill with his fine alignment notations remained blank, and he was growing itchy. PC plus 2 was 7 hours away. Loss of signal when the spacecraft would disappear behind the fast-closing moon was just over 4 hours away. The guidance officers were going to have to come up with at least one good idea and come up with it right quick. In the front row, Dietrich, Reed, and Russell remained huddled for several more minutes and then suddenly stood, filed out of their aisle, and headed toward Griffin's station. "Jerry," Russell said when they arrived at his console, "we're going to have to use the sun to check the existing alignment." Griffin looked at his men in silence. Then he said, "That's the best we can come up with?" "The best we can," Russell said. "Once we get into the shadow of the moon, we can see if a few stars pop out and run a quick confidence check then. But that's only a fallback position." "What's your comfort level on the sun alone?" Griffin asked. "Pretty high," Russell said with as much certainty as he could muster. "Pretty high?" "Yeah," said Dietrich. "But that might be as high as we're likely to get." Griffin studied the faces of his guidance officers and then turned his palms up. "Call Charlie Duke and John Young," he said. "Get them to start trying this thing out in the simulator." In the cockpit of Aquarius, Jim Lovell, Jack Swigert, and Fred Hayes were not thinking about the sun. The body that was claiming most of their attention was 400 times smaller, though it appeared infinitely larger, thousands of times less distant, and was getting bigger and closer by the minute. As John Young and Charlie Duke ran through their paces in the counterfeit LEM, the prime crew in the real ship was barely 12,000 miles away from the moon and whistling toward it at a speed of another 3,000 miles every hour. The closer Aquarius and Odyssey got, the more time the crewmen, despite themselves, spent stealing glances out the windows. They didn't yield to the impulse much at first, and indeed they couldn't afford to yield to it much. The communications system still demanded their constant attention. The ships themselves still required regular thermal rotation. The pre-PC plus 2 power-up was coming up soon, and the debris cloud still had to be monitored for chance breaks that might reveal stars. But no matter how dense the cloud became, no amount of floating rubbish could conceal the immense plaster-gray sphere hanging in front of them. The moon the crew was approaching was a gibbous moon, about 70% illuminated, with only a fat crescent on its western edge lost in darkness. At such close range, the LEM's small triangular windows could no longer contain the mammoth lunar bulk, and in order to take in the entire shape, the crewmen had to lean far forward, craning their necks as far as their limited portholes would allow. For Lovell, the proximity was starting to be a cause for concern. At the moment, his twin ships were about as far from the lunar mountaintops as an airplane leaving, say, Lisbon is from its intended destination in, say, Sydney. And Odyssey and Aquarius were moving 6 times faster than the jet. The commander pushed away from his window and turned to his LEM pilot uneasily. "How do you think they're coming with that alignment business, Fredo?" he asked. "Can't be too great, or we'd have heard something," Hayes said. "Well, our margin of error is vanishing pretty fast." "By 4,400 feet every second," Hayes said, glancing at his computer's velocity display. "What do you say we get them on the line and see if we can't hurry things along?" Lovell said. Before Hayes could transmit the message, however, Houston hailed the ship. "Aquarius, Houston," the Capcom called. From the sound of the voice, it appeared that Vance Brand, another rookie astronaut, had replaced Joe Kerwin at the Capcom console. "Go ahead, Houston," Hayes said. "Okay, we're getting a procedure ready for your alignment," Brand said. "And what we're thinking of is a sun check we'd like you to try at approximately 74 hours. We'll have the data up to you shortly, and it's our feeling that if you're within 1 degree of the target, your platform will be okay, without subsequent alignment. Assuming the sun check is okay, we will then give you a star for a confidence check on the backside when you're in darkness. Over." Hayes repeated the instructions to make sure he heard correctly, then broke off the air and turned to Lovell and Swigert with a questioning expression. Of the three men on board, Hayes was not necessarily the one most qualified to determine the soundness of the plan. Swigert, as navigator of this flight, and Lovell, as the first navigator of the first flight ever to come out this way, were a good deal better versed in the science of celestial steering. "How'd that sound to you?" Hayes asked. Lovell whistled to himself. "Well, it should confirm our alignment." He turned to Swigert. "How's it sound to you?" "Kind of an imprecise method, don't you think?" Swigert said. "Very imprecise," Lovell agreed. "What margin of error did they say they're giving us?" "1 degree. Which is 2 suns, if like aiming for the side of a barn. The question is, Swigert said, unknowingly echoing Reed on the ground, do you have any better ideas? Lovell paused. None at all, he said. Do you? Nope. Call them back, Lovell said, turning to Hayes. Let's get started. Hayes brought Brand back on the line, and the Capcom began reading the LEM pilot the techniques for the sun check. As conceived by Dietrich, Russell, and Reed, and as tested by Duke and Young, the procedure would be relatively straightforward. Lovell would begin by telling the computer he wanted to look through his alignment telescope at the face of the sun. For accuracy's sake, he would specify which quadrant, or, as the guidance men like to say, which limb of the sun. In this case, Reed, Russell, and Dietrich had picked the northeast limb. The guidance system was not accustomed to thinking of the sun as an alignment target, but it knew where to find it. When the computer had processed the command, Lovell would punch the proceed button, and the lunar module's 16 jets would automatically fire, driving the spacecraft around toward the spot where the computer believed the sun to be. If the upper right limb of the giant star floated within 1 degree of the crosshairs in Lovell's highly filtered telescope, he would know his alignment was satisfactory. If it didn't, he would know he was in trouble. Lovell listened to Brand's instructions, allowed Hayes to repeat them back to the ground, and then began shooting questions down to Houston. Had Duke and Young run their simulations with the Mach-Lem in a DOPS configuration? Yes, the Capcom assured him, they had. Had the guidance system had any trouble maneuvering the ship with all the added weight? No, it hadn't. Would the docking radar, which protruded from the top of the lunar module, obstruct the alignment telescope's view of the sun? Not if the radar was retracted before the maneuver. The grilling took the better part of an hour, with Swigert and Hayes throwing in questions when they could, and with such astronauts as Duke, Young, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and David Scott being rounded up in mission control to answer anything the Capcom and the guidance officers couldn't. Finally, at 2:30 in the afternoon, or 73 hours and 31 minutes into the mission, Lovell seemed satisfied. Okay, Houston, he said crisply to Brand. What time is this little sun check supposed to take place? At 74 hours and 29 minutes, Brand answered. Lovell glanced at his watch. How about if we just do it? Why don't we just do it now? Okay, Brand said. You can start at any time. With that go-ahead, the crewmen assumed their workstations, and for the first time since Odyssey was shut down, there was work for Swigert to do. Lovell, it was decided, would position himself at the center of the instrument panel and tend the guidance computer, typing in the data necessary to initiate the sun check and watching the attitude indicators to see if the spacecraft was moving in the correct direction. Swigert would man Hayes' right-hand window, looking for the sun and alerting Lovell as it floated into view. Hayes would move over to Lovell's side, where he would peer through the alignment telescope and note where the crosshairs settled on the sun. In Houston, the ground crew assumed their stations as well. Griffin, like Lunny last night, called for quiet on the loop and asked the men standing behind the consoles to allow the men working them to focus on the job at hand. He pulled his flight log toward him, entered 7332 in the space marked ground elapsed time, and in the blank marked comments wrote, begin sun check. In the spacecraft, Fred Hayes made a final adjustment to his communications hardware and, whether deliberately or accidentally, switched the system back over to hot mic. Instantly, the fractured voices of the astronauts, conferring among themselves, were heard by the ground crew. I don't have all the confidence in the world in this, Lovell was saying, sotto voce. We'll get it, Hayes was saying. Don't be so sure. I still might have screwed up my arithmetic last night. Standing between his own station and his LEM pilot's station, Lovell now entered into Aquarius's computer the information Brand had called up to him. The computer accepted the data, processed it slowly, and then, patient as always, waited for the commander to press proceed. With a glance first at Hayes and then at Swigert, Lovell pushed the button. For a second, nothing happened. Then, all at once, outside the windows, a fine mist of hypergolic gas appeared as the lander's jets fired. Inside, the astronauts could feel the ship begin a lazy turn. In the center of the cockpit, Lovell locked his gaze on the attitude needles. We've got roll, he called out. Now yaw, roll, pitch. Yaw again. Houston, are you reading all this? Negative, Jim, Brand said. We don't have high bitrate coming down from the computer. Roger, Lovell acknowledged, and turned to his right. You see anything yet, Jack? Nothing, Swigert answered. Anything over there? he asked Hayes. Not a thing. In the front row of Mission Control, Russell, Reed, and Dietrich listened to the crew and said nothing. At the Capcom station, Brand held his tongue until he was called again. At the flight director's station, Griffin pulled his log toward him and scribbled the words, Sun Check Initiated. On the air-to-ground loop, the fractured chatter continued to flow back from the crew. Yaw, right side, Hayes could be heard saying. Commander's FDI.
Dead band option,
Lovell responded. Plus 190, Hayes said. Plus 08526.
Give me 16.
I've got HP on the FDI. Two diameters out, no more than that. 0000. Give me the AOT. Give me the AOT. For close to 8 minutes, the murmuring of the crew continued as Aquarius swung its bulk around and the controllers eavesdropped in silence. Then, from off the right side of the ship, Swigert thought he saw something. A small flash, then nothing, then a flash again. All at once, unmistakably, a tiny degree of the solar arc flowed into the corner of his window. He snapped his head to the right, then turned back to the left to alert Lovell. But before he could say anything, a shard of a sunbeam fell across the instrument panel, and the commander, monitoring his needles, looked up with a start. Call it, Jack, he said. What do you see?
We've got a sun, Swigert said. We've got a big one,
Lovell responded with a smile. You see anything, Fredo?
No,
Hayes said, squinting into his telescope. Then, as his eyepiece filled with light,
yes, maybe a third of a diameter.
It's coming in, Lovell said, glancing out the window and turning away slightly as the sun filled it.
I think it's coming in.
Just about there, said Hayes.
We've got it, Lovell called. I think we've got it.
Okay, Hayes said, watching as the disk of the sun brushed the crosshairs of the telescope and slid downward.
Just about there.
Do you have it? Lovell asked.
Just about there, Hayes repeated.
In the telescope, the sun slid down another fraction of a degree, then a fraction of a fraction. The thrusters puffed hypergolics for another second or so, and then silently, the little jets cut off as the ship and the sun came to a stop. Lovell said, What have you got? What have you got? Hayes said nothing, then slowly pulled away from the telescope and turned to his crewmates with a huge grin. Upper right corner of the sun, he announced.
We've got it,
Lovell shouted, pumping a fist in the air.
We're hot,
Hayes said.
Houston, Aquarius,
Lovell called.
Go ahead, Aquarius,
Brand answered.
Okay, said Lovell. It looks like the sun check passes.
We understand, Brand said.
We're kind of glad to hear that.
In Mission Control, where only moments before Gerald Griffin had called for absolute quiet, a whoop went up from the Retro, Fido, and Guido in the first row. It was taken up by the Inco and the Telmu and the surgeon in the second row. Across the room, an undisciplined, unprecedented, utterly un-NASA-like ovation slowly spread.
Houston, Aquarius,
Lovell called through the noise. Did you copy that?
Copy,
Brand said through his own broad grin.
It's not quite centered, the commander reported. It's a little bit less than a radius to one side.
It sounds good. It sounds good. Brand glanced over his shoulder and smiled at Griffin, who grinned back and let the tumult go on around him. Disorder was not a good thing in Mission Control, but for a few more seconds at least, Griffin would allow it. He pulled his flight log toward him, and in the blank space under the ground elapsed time column, he wrote, 7347. In the space under the comments column, he scribbled, Sun check complete. Looking down, the flight director discovered for the first time that his hands were shaking. Looking at the page, he discovered for the first time, too, that his last three entries were completely illegible. To the people around her, Marilyn Lovell appeared surprisingly unmoved by the success of Aquarius' sun check. The guests gathered around the television in the Lovell family room were almost all NASA people, schooled in the ways of lunar flight and well aware of how important the event was. For those few who weren't, the network broadcasters made things unmistakably clear. The prospects for the safe return of the crew depended largely on the outcome of the PC-plus-2 burn, and the prospects for the burn depended almost entirely on the outcome of the sun check. The reaction in the Lovell home when Jim Lovell radioed down the success of the maneuver was thus much the same as it was in Mission Control. Whoops, hugs, and handshakes. Marilyn herself, however, simply nodded and closed her eyes. though many of the people in the room observed Marilyn's reaction with some concern. Susan Borman, sitting to her left, and Jane Conrad, sitting to her right, understood. Like Marilyn, and like all of the other women who had kept similar vigils since the early days of Mercury, Susan and Jane had long since learned that one of the most important things an astronaut's wife needed to remember during the course of a flight was how to ration her reactions. Though the networks could afford to dramatize every tweak of a thruster or torque of a platform for the TV audience, the people whose fathers and husbands and sons were riding inside the spacecraft did not have that freedom. For them, the flight wasn't national news. It was, in the most literal sense, domestic news. It wasn't the future of the nation that rode on the outcome, but the future of the household. With stakes that high, the wives, at least, could not afford the luxury of a fully emotional response at each critical turning point. Whoop or weep during liftoff if you must. Cry or cheer during splashdown. Clasp your children's hands during ascents from the moon. But outside those moments, simply nod and move on. The one concession Marilyn had allowed herself to displays of less stoic emotion had been her occasional, almost dreamy lapses into reminiscences about the earlier, less newsworthy days of her husband's career. Two or three times since last night, Marilyn's face had taken on a calm, faraway expression, and, with something approximating a smile, she would turn to whoever happened to be next to her and recall some happier, safer day years back. "Did you know Jim liked rockets as a kid?" Marilyn had said to Pete Conrad when the two of them and a handful of other guests had found themselves in Lovell's study earlier today. "Yeah, he told me," Conrad said. "Built some exploding rocket in high school or something. He even wrote his Naval Academy term paper about rockets." Marilyn reached to her husband's bookshelf and withdrew an old Annapolis folder. "Read the last paragraph," she said, flipping open to a sheaf of yellowed onion skin paper stapled together at the corner. "Marilyn," Conrad said, wondering whether reminiscing like this was a good idea at such an uncertain time. "Please read it." Conrad took the folder from Marilyn and read, "The big day for rockets is still coming. The day when science will have advanced to the stage when flight into space is reality and not a dream. That will be the day when the advantage of rocket power, simplicity, high thrust, and the ability to operate in a vacuum will be used to best advantage." "Not bad for 1951, huh?" Marilyn said. "Not bad. Of course, if NASA had had their way the first time Jim applied, he never would have ridden any rocket." "Jim and me both," Pete said. "You know, 7 years after he flunked that first physical, the doctor in charge came by the Space Center for a visit. By that time, Jim had made his two Gemini flights, and he had all these certificates on his wall. When the doctor dropped in, Jim pointed to all the commendations and said to him, 'You guys are pretty good at measuring bilirubin, but the one thing you never thought to measure is persistence and motivation.'" Conrad smiled at this. "He loved telling that story, Pete," Marilyn said, her voice cracking. Abruptly, she looked away. "Marilyn," Conrad had said, mustering as much conviction as he could, "he is coming home." Whether it was a good or a bad idea for Marilyn to permit herself such musings, no one in her house could say. But this afternoon, when her husband had finished his makeshift sun check, she apparently had no need for them. What she did instead, while her guests hugged and cheered, was rise, excuse herself, and walk toward the kitchen. A few hours earlier, Father Donald Raich, a local Episcopal priest who had known the Lovell family for years, had phoned and offered to stop by for an impromptu communion. Marilyn enjoyed Father Raich's company, welcomed his visit, a time when, for an hour at least, someone else would be the spiritual pillar in her family room, and wanted to be able to offer him something other than the stale coffee she had been drinking. Before Marilyn even reached the kitchen, the doorbell rang, and Dot Thompson went to answer it. Father Raich entered and greeted Marilyn warmly, then joined the crowd in the family room. With his arrival, the atmosphere in the room changed dramatically. The volume of the television was turned down, the volume of the voices in the room dropped with it, and the house regained, if only for a short time, some of the normalcy that had prevailed before 9:30 last night. Marilyn and the other guests had barely assembled around the coffee table where the service would be held when Betty Benware appeared at her side and whispered to her, "Marilyn, did you tell the children Father Raich was coming?" Marilyn said, "I mean, I think I did. Why?" "Well, if you did tell Susan, she forgot. She just came downstairs, saw everybody talking to a priest, and now she's hysterical. She thinks you've all given up. She thinks Jim isn't coming back." Marilyn excused herself, ran upstairs to Susan's room, and found her second youngest child crying inconsolably. Gathering her up, Marilyn assured Susan that no one was giving up hope.
that the people at the Space Center had nearly everything under control, and that the priest was here just to help take care of those things that were beyond even the Space Center folks. When her daughter did not seem reassured, Marilyn took her hand, tiptoed downstairs, and signaled to Betty that the two of them would be back in a few minutes. Slipping out the kitchen door, Marilyn and Susan made their way down to Taylor Lake and sat on a patch of grass in the shadow of a nearby tree.
"Now tell me exactly what you're worried about," Marilyn said when they had settled themselves.
"What do you mean?" Susan said, confused. "I'm worried that Dad's not going to come home."
"That?" Marilyn asked with mock astonishment. "That's what's bothering you?"
Sure. "Don't you know your father's too mean to die?" Marilyn said with a smile.
"He's not mean," Susan protested.
"No, of course he's not, but he's stubborn, right?"
Susan nodded.
"And he's smart, right?"
Susan nodded again.
"And he's the best astronaut I know."
"The best one I know, too," Susan said.
"Now, do you really think the best astronaut either one of us knows is going to forget something as simple as how to turn his spaceship around and fly it home?"
"No," Susan said, laughing hesitantly.
"No," Marilyn said. "I don't think so either. What I'm concerned about is all those other people at the house who haven't figured that out yet. Don't you think we ought to go straighten them out?"
Susan agreed, and Marilyn and her daughter walked slowly back to their home. When they arrived, the prayer service appeared to have been completed, and the first voice Marilyn heard was not Father Raish's, but, she was almost certain, Jim's. Marilyn and Susan stood in the doorway for a brief, disoriented instant before realizing that the voice was coming from the television set. In the family room, most of the guests were crowded around the screen, where Lovell was visible, looking natty in blue blazer and necktie, and sitting comfortably in an ABC studio talking to Jules Bergman. Marilyn remembered the day last month when Jim had sat for the taped interview, an interview that, he had told her later, consisted mostly of Bergman asking him repeatedly whether he'd ever experienced fear during his career as a test pilot or an astronaut. Marilyn had picked out the tie Jim wore that day, thinking it would look good on television. Now, despite everything, she couldn't help noticing that it did. "You know, Jules," Jim was saying, "I think every pilot has known fear. I think those who say they haven't are only kidding themselves. But we have confidence in the equipment we're working with, and that overcomes any fear we have of using it." "Is there a specific instance in an airplane emergency when you can recall fear?" Bergman asked.
"Oh, I've had an engine flame out a few times in an aircraft," Lovell said, "and I was kind of curious whether it was going to light up again, things of that nature. But they seem to work out."
"Do you believe the law of averages operates with you after all these flights? Do you worry about getting stuck on the moon, for example?"
"No. I kind of feel that every time we make these flights, we count on two things. First of all, you've got to be well-trained to handle emergencies. That's like money in the bank. Second, you've got to remember that every time you go, it's like a new roll of the dice. It's not like something that accumulates so that you're bound to get a 7 after a while. You start out fresh every time."
"So the ascent engine failing to ignite, or things like that, don't really worry you?"
"No," Lovell said with a shake of his head. "If they worried me, I wouldn't be going."
Bergman persisted. "Let me put the equation a different way. How do the risks you take compare to the risks a combat pilot takes, say an F-4 pilot in Vietnam?" Lovell drew a deep breath and thought for a moment. "Certainly we take a risk," he said at last. "Going to the moon and using the systems we use is risky, but we use the best technology we have to minimize that risk. When you go into combat, the other side is using the best technology they have to maximize your risk. Obviously, I think that's a very dangerous proposition."
"So you feel you have the better half of the draw in this case," Bergman said.
"I feel," Lovell said, evidently tiring of this line of questioning, "that a combat pilot in Vietnam is in a very risky position." The interview ended, and the cameras returned live to Bergman and Frank Reynolds in the ABC studio in New York. Marilyn turned to Susan and smiled. "See," she said, "Dad's a lot safer than people who go into combat, and those people usually make it home." Susan seemed relieved, ran out of the family room and toward the backyard. Marilyn, too, thought she felt a bit better. It was true that all over America, thousands of wives lived every day knowing their husbands were flying into combat on the other side of the world, not knowing whether they'd return. And those women didn't have Jules Bergman giving them regular updates on how things were going, Navy vessels mobilizing to pluck them out of the water, or dozens of men in a giant control room monitoring their every breath. Of course, those women's husbands also weren't a quarter of a million miles from home, surrounded by a near-absolute vacuum, flying a crippled ship, and in danger not just of failing to make it back to their carrier or their airbase,
but failing to make it back to the very planet where their journey began. Marilyn sat down slowly on the couch and felt her spirits sink again. All things considered, she wasn't entirely sure where she'd want her husband to be. The sun was beginning to set on Marilyn Lovell's house in Houston at almost the same instant it was setting on Jim Lovell's spacecraft 240,000 miles away. With the exception of the two quick passes Apollo 13 had made over the nighttime side of the Earth during its parking orbit around the home planet, the sun had been a constant presence. It wasn't always directly visible, but it was always there, heating the craft during thermal rolls, illuminating the debris after the bang in the service module, glinting off the instrument panel during the alignment check. Now, at 6:30 in the evening, as the visitors in the family room settled around the TV, and as Apollo 13 closed to within 1,500 miles of the moon, less than the distance of a single lunar diameter, the ship and the sun at last began to part ways. Like all other lunar spacecraft, Odyssey and Aquarius were approaching the moon from its western edge. In the case of the gibbous moon that hung in the sky tonight, that meant its shadowed edge. The closer the spacecraft got, the deeper it moved into that darkness. Though some ambient sunshine still bathed the ships, all that reflected up from the surface and into the windows of the steadily darkening cockpit was a weak, shimmery earthshine, the reflected light of the home planet, which was itself only reflecting the light of the sun. What this deepening gloom also meant was that less and less light was reflecting off the sparkling debris cloud that still surrounded the ships. As of an hour ago, Lovell, Hayes, and Swigert resumed their customary left, right, and rear stations, and as Hayes pored over his engine burn checklists and Swigert lent a hand where he could, Lovell returned to his window. "I've got Scorpio," the commander announced. "You have?" Hayes asked, stopping what he was doing and turning toward his window. "Yeah, and Antares." "They're all coming out," Swigert said, straining for a glimpse through Lovell's window. "You said it," Lovell said. "There's Nunki, there's Antares. We may have enough here for that confidence check." Swigert agreed. "We've probably got more than enough." "You want to let them know?" Hayes asked. "Yeah," Lovell said, and called into his microphone. "Houston, Aquarius." "Go ahead, Jim," Brand said. "Be advised I've got Antares and Nunki in the window, and I just wanted to know if you wanted to try that alignment check." "Roger," Brand said. "We copy the stars you are seeing. Stand by for word on the confidence check." In mission control, Brand clicked off the air-to-ground loop and onto the flight director's loop to confer with his Guido. True to the rumors that had been circulating around mission control for most of the day, Kranz's group had come back on console about 2 hours ago and intended to stay for the next few hours at least. For much of the afternoon, Milt Winsler's maroon team had been standing by at the edges of the mission control auditorium like a football taxi squad, ready to relieve Griffin's group when their shift ended shortly before sundown. But Kranz had put out the word to the room at large, and to his friend Windler in particular, that at the risk of bruising feelings, he'd just as soon send his own men out to handle the PC-plus-2 and let Windler's team take over later. At 4:30, the Tiger team came out of room 210 practically at a trot, fanned out around mission control, and with murmured shrugged apologies, commandeered the consoles they had vacated at 10:30 last night. Griffin's gold controllers, who were minutes away from being relieved anyway, surrendered their seats and retreated to the aisles to join Windler's maroon team. Now, as Brand reviewed the alignment plans with Bill Fenner, the white team Guido, and Fenner reviewed them with Kranz, the first differences between the white team's stewardship of the flight and the gold team's emerged. The star check that could help confirm the accuracy of the platform, Kranz announced on the loop, would be scratched. The alignment Lovell had transferred from Odyssey last night had proved itself adequate during the free return burn and had been recertified during the makeshift sun check. Screwing around with things now, Kranz believes, was just asking for trouble and was a sure way to squander both thruster fuel and time. He passed his decision on to Fenner, who passed it on to Brand, who called it up to the crew. "Hey, Aquarius," the Capcom announced, "we're pretty much satisfied with our present alignment. We don't want to waste any more thruster gas trying to check it further. So why don't we just stay where we are?" "Okay, understand," Lovell said, and then pushed his microphone away and turned to Hayes with a slight eye roll. "First time in the whole flight we've got stars, and now we don't want to use them." "They're nervous about messing things up for the burn," Hayes said, trying to be diplomatic. "I'm nervous about messing things up before we even get there." The issue of the star check was fast becoming academic, since the time to conduct it was running out anyway. The spacecraft's proximity to the front side of the moon meant it was less than an hour and a half away from arcing around the backside and vanishing from radio contact. The loss of signal would be briefer than it had been the last time Lovell made the trip, because unlike the Apollo 8 crew, whose first job upon disappearing behind the lunar sphere was to apply a hypergolic brake and drop into orbit, the Apollo 13 crew would do nothing at all. Passing behind the west side of the moon at 75 hours and 8 minutes into the flight, they would come tear-assing around the east side just 25 minutes later, their speed having been gravitationally increased during the time they were out of contact with the Earth. 2 hours after that, they would have to be ready to fire their engine. "Aquarius, Houston," Brand called up. "If you're ready to copy, I can give you the maneuvering data for the PC plus two, and then you might want to prepare for loss of signal." "Okay," Hayes said, pulling out a notepad and pen. "I'm ready to copy." Brand read up all the data, calling out vectors and yaw angles and eventual Earth landing targets, and Hayes copied them down and read them back. Lovell heard concern in the Capcom's voice, but he was pleased to find that he felt a relative sense of calm as the loss of signal and the burn itself approached. This burn, unlike the free return burn, would be a long, strong one, with the engine firing for 5 seconds at minimum thrust, then 21 seconds at 40% thrust, and finally 4 minutes at full thrust. Like the free return burn, it would be initiated and terminated by the computer, with Lovell handling only the throttle that would control the strength of the burn. If the engine did not fire at precisely 79, 27, 40.07, he would take over that function too, using two bright red, silver dollar-sized buttons, with the words start and stop stenciled beneath them, on the commander's side of the spacecraft. The buttons provided a direct link between the descent engine and the batteries, and when pressed, would bypass the computer and ignite the engine on command. Though it was only a late ignition that would require Lovell to hit the start switch, there were many situations in which he would hit stop. According to mission rules, the commander would be required to terminate the burn maneuver if his thruster or fuel pressure fell too low, if his oxidizer pressure climbed too high, if his attitude drifted by 10 degrees or more, or if his instrument panel flashed any one of 6 battery, computer, or engine gimbal alarms. Worst of all, Lovell knew, was what would happen if he received an alarm telling him that the helium tanks in the fuel system were becoming overpressurized. Rather than using malfunction-prone pumps to force engine fuel through the lines in the descent stage of the LEM, NASA engineers relied on compressed helium fed from high-pressure tanks. Channeled into the fuel lines, the inert gas would not react with the explosive hypergolic fluid, but would instead push it along to the combustion chamber. The system was nearly flawless, with just one exception. Helium has the lowest boiling point of all the elements, so the slightest change in temperature can cause it to vaporize and expand. Compressing a gas that requires so much elbow room into a highly confining tank can be a recipe for disaster, and in order to prevent pressure explosions, NASA equipped the line that ran from the tank with a diaphragm-like burst disc. In the event of a sudden pressure increase, the diaphragm would rupture, releasing the gas before the pressure climbed too high. Venting the helium meant that the engine would no longer be able to fire, but in a normal lunar flight, that would not be a problem. The helium system was not intended to be heated up and switched on until the descent engine was ready to burn. And the descent engine was designed to burn only once, carrying the LEM from lunar orbit to lunar landing. Any rupture of the burst disc after that would take place on the moon's surface, where the engine would already have been permanently shut down, and the gas could escape harmlessly into the surrounding vacuum. What nobody had ever considered, but what the commander of Apollo 13 was now confronting, was what would happen on a mission in which the engine had to be fired and shut down and fired again and shut down again. If the burst disc in the overworked fuel line should blow now, the descent propulsion system would be lost for good. Despite all this, Lovell felt a surprising equanimity as the burn approached, and while Hayes continued taking data dictation from Brand, the commander took another moment to glance out his window. As it turned out, he picked just the right moment. At 76 hours, 42 minutes, and 7 seconds into the mission, the sun set behind the moon, and Apollo 13 moved completely into shadow. Outside the spacecraft, the sparkling debris at last disappeared, and on all sides of the ship, at all angles and in all axes, the sky was suddenly lit up with curtains of ice-white stars. "Houston," Lovell said, "the sun has gone down, and, man, look at those stars." "Is that Nunki out there?" Hayes asked, turning to the window and pointing to the star Lovell had barely spotted earlier, but that now stood out like a lighthouse beacon. "Yes," said Lovell, "and I can see Antares much better." "What's that cloud over there?" Swigert asked, leaning over Lovell's shoulder. "The Milky Way," Lovell answered, indicating the bright white bands that bisected the sky. "No, not the illuminated one," Swigert said. "The dark one. Actually, two dark ones that look like contrails." Lovell followed Swigert's gaze and saw a pair of eerily dark columns blotting out some of the newly visible stars. "I can't for the life of me figure out what that would be," he said. "It might be debris that was thrown out there." "From our maneuvers?" Hayes asked. "No," Lovell said. "From our explosion." All three astronauts looked at the clouds and fell quiet. It had been close to 24 hours since last night's sudden jolt and bang, and the sense memory of the experience had begun to fade. But these ghostly black fingers extending from their ship and reaching out into space brought it instantly back. It still wasn't clear what had gone wrong in the rear of their spacecraft, but lest they forget, it had made a smoking mess out of a vehicle that was supposed to be all but indestructible. Brand's voice broke the quiet. "Aquarius, Houston." "Go ahead, Houston." "Okay, Jim, we have a little over 2 minutes until loss of signal, and everything's looking good here." "Roger," Lovell said. "I take it you don't want us to activate any other systems or make any other preparations until we reacquire signal." "Roger, that's correct," Brand said. "Okay, we'll just sit tight then. See you on the other side." The Apollo 13 crew fell back into silence, and 120 seconds later, the signal from Houston disappeared. Slipping past Earthshine and into the absolute darkness and radio silence behind the moon, the crew remained subdued. Since only a crescent on the western end of the front of the moon was in shadow, only a corresponding crescent on the diagonal end of the backside was illuminated. For most of Apollo 13's transit around the moon, therefore, there was nothing but shadow beneath the ship. The only thing that revealed there was a body down there at all was the utter absence of stars, an absence that began where the ground ought to begin and ended in the distance where the horizon ought to start. For close to 20 minutes, the astronauts coasted over this nighttime nothingness until just 5 minutes before reacquisition of signal, a white-gray sickle of mottled turf appeared in the distance. Hayes, at his right-hand window, saw it first and reached for his camera. Lovell, at his left-hand window, saw it next and nodded less in rapture than recognition. Swigert, who had never seen such a thing before, grabbed his camera and glided toward Lovell's station, and the commander floated backward to let his rookie crewmate see what was unfolding below. Sliding beneath the ship, just as it had slid beneath Apollo 8 almost 16 months earlier, was the same desolate stretch that had never been glimpsed by human beings until 1968, and that had now been seen by more than a dozen. Swigert and Hayes, like Borman, Lovell, and Anders before them, were transfixed. They scanned the mares and craters, the rills and the hills, the great sweep of the lunar terrain, in respectful silence. Unlike the crews aboard previous ships, this crew wasn't passing overhead at 60 miles, but at 139. And unlike the crews of previous Apollos, they weren't here to stay. As soon as they passed to the eastern side, they would begin climbing away, and Lovell drifted to the back of the cabin and let his junior pilots look their fill. 5 minutes later, at the appointed time for reacquisition of signal, he flipped his microphone switch to its transmit setting and called back down to Earth in a considerate whisper. "Good morning, Houston. How do you read?" "Reading you fairly well," Brand said. "All right," Lovell said. "We read you fairly well, too." He looked over Swigert's shoulder and glanced at the formation sliding by below him. "And for your information, we're coming up on Mare Smithii now, and it looks like we're climbing away." "We're really zooming off now," Swigert added, a little sorrowfully. "Oh, yes, yes," Lovell responded as much to his crew member as to the ground. "We're no longer at 139 miles. We're leaving." "Copy that, Aquarius," Brand said. "What we're still going to need is a power-up time for the burn," Lovell reminded the ground. "Okay, stand by." Brand clicked off the line. And while Hayes and Swigert remained at the windows with their cameras, Lovell began moving about the cockpit, nervously fussing with his breakers in preparation for the power-up. Drifting from one section of his instrument panel to another, he found himself reaching around Hayes and Swigert, occasionally muttering an, "Excuse me, Fredo," or an, "I'm sorry, Jack." The LEM pilot and the command module pilot would respond to their commander with a nod, absently moving out of the way to allow Lovell to reach what he needed, and then floating back into place. After 2 or 3 minutes of this, Lovell stopped, backed up onto the ascent engine cover, which until this moment he had assumed was Swigert's station, and folded his arms. "Gentlemen," he said in a voice deliberately too loud for the tiny cockpit, "what are your intentions?" Startled, Hayes and Swigert spun around. "Our intentions?" Swigert said. "Yes," said Lovell. We have a PC plus two maneuver coming up. Is it your intention to participate in it? Jim, Hayes said somewhat feebly, this is our last chance to get these shots. We've come all the way out here. Don't you think they're going to want us to bring back some pictures? If we don't get home, you'll never get them developed, Lovell said. Now look it. Let's get the cameras squared away and let's get all set to burn. We're not going to hack it with a splashdown at 152 hours. Hayes and Swigert stowed their cameras and returned to their stations somewhat sheepishly. And for the next hour or so, the crew worked purposefully. With Brand dictating the power-up instructions and the crew throwing the appropriate switches, Aquarius's systems were slowly armed and brought online. As with the lunar orbit insertion burn on Apollo 8, the Apollo 13 astronauts waited in silence for the final few minutes leading up to their maneuver to tick away. There would be no canvas restraints for the pilots to use this time, no couches to strap themselves safely into. Instead, they would simply stand, brace themselves against the bulkhead, absorb the sudden thrust, and feel the subtle press of acceleration through their now comfortably zero-G bodies. Lovell looked over at Hayes and flashed a thumbs up, then looked back over his shoulder at Swigert and did the same. By the way, Aquarius, Brand announced, interrupting the quiet, we see the results of Apollo 12's seismometer. Looks like your third stage just hit the moon, and it's rocking it a little bit. Well, at least something worked on this flight, Lovell said. Sure glad we didn't have a LAM impact, too. Lovell looked down at the moon as if he could see the scatter of dust and the small crater created by the latest projectile to hit the ancient surface. What he saw instead was a tiny, perfectly triangular mountain, tucked among the craters and hills that lined the edge of the Sea of Tranquility. It was Mount Marilyn, hailing him back as he climbed up and away, presumably forever. 10 minutes to burn, Hayes announced. Shortly afterward, he called, 8 minutes to burn, then 6 minutes to burn, then 4 minutes to burn. Finally, Brand at his Capcom station took up the call. Jim, you are go for the burn. Go for the burn. Roger, I understand, Lovell said. We are go for the burn. 2 minutes and 40 seconds on my mark, Brand called. Mark. Lovell looked at his mission timer, marked the time that remained, drew a breath, and held it. It was, he thought a little grimly, the night flight in the Sea of Japan all over again. With his cockpit blacked out and the prow of his ship pointed toward the glowing blue algae streak of Earth, he watched the clock count down to zero and felt the LAM rumble to life beneath his feet.
All right, and that is our reading for tonight here on the Jumbo Braille program here at the Six Eyes Radio Network. This is Big Dot with you and wondering who we got with us, Ghost Dot Ruth.
Well, we have Father, Son, Holy Ghost, Band of Angels. You have you. We have Amstad and your Uncle Sandy.
All right. Now, he probably wants to talk, but he can't press the number one, Ruth. So if you want to push the nut, go ahead and open his mic. That's okay.
Okay, his mic is open. If you want to talk, Sandy, I got you open. You can speak.
What are you
listening to? Sandy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Sandy. Is
that Kenny? Yeah. Kenny, I'll be right with you.
All right.
Sounds good to me. Six left, but we still got you all here.
All right.
I was taking my pills.
All right.
Hi, Kenny.
Hello,
Answer
everybody.
Hi.
And hi, Ann. How you doing, Precious?
Glad to have you guys with us tonight. Have you guys seen Apollo 13, the movie?
No, I never seen the movie, but I've read the book.
Well, that's what we're reading tonight. That's what we're reading tonight, The Lost Moon. The Perilous Voyage of Apollo 13 by Jim Lovell and Jeffrey Kluger. That's
yeah, we'll have to have
reading.
Them both over sometime and they can watch the movie because it's similar to the book, but that book is really, really more detailed.
Yeah, so that's what we were listening to tonight.
Okay.
So, yeah, and to our listeners, Sandy here is talking about in the future doing a handyman type program of where you guys can find different little things about things around the house, that kind of thing, that might interest you. And we'll just give him a little chance here to just give an example. Like three-way switches, Sandy, describe the wiring of a three-way switch.
Well, a three-way switch wire, you got the colors are black, white, red, blue, and solid copper, which is
okay.
Secondary ground. And on the three-way switch, you got three screws. They're black, gold, and silver, and green.
Okay.
You want me to tell you how to hook them up?
Yep, that's part of what we're asking.
Okay. That's pretty simple, too. You got to go to your local hardware store, which you know, and you got to buy the switch boxes to put on in. And the you need a splice box, and you'll need a light kit, like a fan kit, you know, like from ceiling or something. And then you just start putting the wire in. It's pretty well simple. You got to buy wire. You got to buy two different types of wire, though. Probably your brother, isn't it? But you got to get 12-3 wire and you got to get 12-2 wire. That's my answer machine. Wait 1 minute.
You know, I bet he knows how to put up a ceiling fan, too.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay.
Thank
you.
Or call me back. All right. Bye.
I'll call you back next year. Okay.
Okay, well, go on.
Okay.
You were talking about 12-3 wire and 12-2 wire.
Yeah. Now, you 12-2 wire, you're going to need to run it from the power, from the trip box, your service box, I'll call it, to your splice box. And then your 12-3 wire, it runs from the splice box to your two switches, and you know, have to have a piece of 12-2 to go from the splice box to the light kit.
Okay.
And how to hook it up is very simple. Like I said, in the 12-3 wire, you got four colors of wire. You got blue, red, black, white, and solid copper. With solid copper is the secondary ground. But when you go to hook it up in your splice box, you hook all the blues together, all the reds, all the whites, and then you hook all the all the reds, all the blues, all the blacks, and all the whites. And then you put the secondary ground, you put all them secondary grounds, you twist them together, and you put them together. And then when you go to your switches, there's a switch you got to watch right there. That's where the people get confused. On the switches, like I said, you got black, silver, and gold. And you got to put the black. There's a reason for the black switch, the black screw, the silver screw, and the gold screw. Okay. The gold screw and the silver screw, you put the blue one on the...
Hey, are you there?
No, I'm not here. You put the blue wire on the silver screw, and you put the red wire on the gold screw. The black wire goes on the black screw, of course, and then you got your secondary ground, which that's the copper wire. Now, then you still got, you should have all your whites, but you just twist them to take them, then the whites, and you just hook that down there to that other screw. Okay? That's pretty well. Oh, another thing I was going to do. Huh?
All right.
And I thought maybe when I do this show, I was thinking about not only helping people out do things, projects, I can also do projects to show them how to build things. How about a Genesee coffee?
It's part of what you're talking about, handyman stuff and carpentry, that kind of thing. But Ruth was mentioning ceiling fans. How do you put a ceiling fan up?
It goes according to the brand of the ceiling fan. There's ceiling huggers, and there's the ones that hang down a little farther. I don't really care for the ones that hang down too far, because if you get them, put them on high, and they start whipping too much, then you can pull the thing right off the ceiling if it's going too much. And if you don't keep them balanced.
Maybe it's smart, just have AC.
The ceiling huggers, I feel that I like them better than I do the other ones. But it's pretty simple to put a ceiling fan in. You run your wire, you can run a piece of 12-2 wire from your service box to a switch on the wall. Then you run the wire from the switch box up to your fan. And it's pretty well explanatory. But like I was saying, once again, you got all your blacks, all your reds, and so on. Or there's a red, white, I'm going to say. And a ceiling fan is pretty easy to put in. You only got three wires on a ceiling fan. That's a black, a blue, and a white. And so, but like I was saying, not only I'm going to try to sit on the show and explain to people how to do things, but I'm going to show them, maybe I can teach them how to build things, like how about a Genesee coffee table or a Pepsi coffee table. And you wondered how I make a Pepsi coffee table, right?
Sounds interesting.
If you make it out of Pepsi cans.
I'm all ears, too.
Huh?
What'd he say? She said she's all ears. But
okay.
We could save this for a future show. That kind of keep people interested and call in. They can get in contact with us one of two ways. They could either dial 424-243-9617. Again, 424-243-9617. Press number 1. Just let us know. You would be definitely interested in this kind of show. Or B, you can email us at feelandtouchking@gmail.com. That's F-E-E-L. The letter N is Nancy, T-O-U-C-H-K-I-N-G @gmail.com, or 6i6@gmail.com, S-I-X-E-Y-E-S, the digit number 6@gmail.com. And in your subject line, put Handyman Program for Jumbo Braille Program. And we will not only read it, but get back in contact with you. We'd love to hear your thoughts on such a show. And we definitely could use the listeners and questions that would be posed to Sandy on his program that he's thinking about. All right. So.
Yeah, you don't realize how much stuff people throw away they can make things out of. Okay.
One man's trash is another man's treasure. So, all right, we're going to do, we're going to close out for tonight, and we're going to catch everybody tomorrow, 9 p.m. right here at the Successor Radio Network for the Talk with Missionary Ken and Ruth Wolfgang Show, and we hope everybody enjoys, and we're going to catch you tomorrow, and we'll say good night to everybody.
Okay. Good night, everybody.
Have a nice sleep, everyone.
God bless you.
You too. You and I have a good blessed evening too. Get good sleep.
Like I said, God bless everybody.
Amen.
Good night.
Sleep tight.